Hello? Hang on 1 minute.
What's happening?
Introduction.
Oh, okay. I don't suppose we're on the air, are we?
We are on the air right now live. Here we go. Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooke Fagley. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are and why we are here and what we may become if you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Did you know you have existed for many thousands of years? The thought of reincarnation escapes most people, as it did me until I read this book. Your Never-Ending Life is the first in the Universal Learning Series from Sandy Andrew. Search your higher mind, find your soulmate, and know that you are never alone in this world. The treasures of the eternities are yours, and your first step is to read the book. Quit the Banner for Your Never-Ending Life by Sandy Andrew at X Squared Radio and order the book today. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and the Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysms? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two of this series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com. Get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. Welcome this Sunday, September 10th, to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. It is a comfortable 76 degrees here in western Kentucky. Sunspot 904 is sizable but harmless for powerful solar flares. The solar wind is still active at 357.9 kilometers per second, and there are no coronal holes facing Earth at the moment. We here at X Squared Radio want you to do three things for us. We have committed in the past to bringing you all of our content for free. This week, that has changed. Economics has required us to begin requiring a subscription in order to listen to the archives. It's a nominal fee, of about $2.50 a month if you want to listen month by month, or if you want to buy a year's subscription, it's less than $2 a month. It does take a little bit of money to operate these radio programs, and up until now we've been doing it out of our pockets. And we appreciate your patronage to our many affiliates, but it has not been enough to make the ends meet. So you can continue to listen live for free, and if you will sign up for the newsletter, we'll make sure that you get a discount on the subscription to the archives. But when you get ready to buy inkjet cartridges or historical replicas or other neat stuff for your space, please shop the affiliates at X Squared Radio. The prices are low, and in most cases you get free shipping. And also, don't forget to sign up for the newsletter and give us the call letters of your local AM radio station. If you'll do those things, we'll keep the cost as low as we can. And in certain cases, as a certain five-year-old out there that likes to listen to the archives during the week when she gets home, I have sent them a coupon so that they can listen for free for a year. I'm not an ungenerous person, but we do have some bills to meet. Next week, we are going to be pleased to have Stan Deo on the program. He is the spokesman for the Millennial Arc, and Stan Deo has held above top secret security clearance and worked undercover for the FBI. He was part of an exclusive black project headed by Dr. Edward Teller, specializing in the development of flying saucer technology. You don't want to miss that show. If you want to stay current on our program's guests, books, CDs, DVDs, and other outstanding stuff for your space, you can make X Squared Radio your favorite place on the web by going to x2-radio.com. Also, please go to our MySpace link behind the X Squared Radio logo at our website and sign up as a friend. We'll have some promotions that will save you some money coming through there soon. Tonight, our special guest is probably the most informed environmental expert on Earth, Michael Sunanda. Michael has a BS, an MS, student of whole energy systems with Buckminster Fuller. I don't know if you're familiar with him, a very famous physicist and chemist, and came up with buckyballs and bucky tubes, without which molecular biology would be crippled today. His website is a little difficult to get out because I don't know how to explain the sideways squiggly, so perhaps he can give us a better website address. But we are going to discuss the ecology of Gaia, the interaction of man with the Earth, and other very provocative and exciting subjects in the news today. Please welcome with me Michael Sunanda. How are you this evening?
Aloha. So it's evening there, huh?
Yes, it's approximately 5:15 Central Time, 6:15 Eastern Time.
Oh, Well, I guess it's earlier here and later there. So, it's very hot here. It's been hot all season, and it's been raining less here than it has in years.
Wow. Well, in the first hour, I would like to talk about the pulse of the Earth. I think each of us have a feeling that the Earth is in some way alive, that it has a rhythm and a life force. So let's talk about the electromagnetic nature of the Earth. Does the Earth, well, I'm falling back a little bit in Newtonian paradigms here, but what is gravity?
Okay, there's two main forces, gravity and radiation. And the radiation we would call electric, and the gravity is magnetism. The force of it is a little hard to understand because it's so invisible. The magnetism is invisible, but the only way you can see it is by those little magnet experiments that they do.
Uh-huh.
But it has a pattern, and the pattern, well, there's two things about the magnetism. One is the pattern of it, which is a circle torusphere, like a donut.
Right.
And the center of the sphere or the orb is the axis. And that's the axis of the Earth. It's the center. It's the axis of a tree, volcanoes, anything that grows or has a center to it, and everything revolves around it. So that's the shape of the magnetic field. I call it a gyroscope or gyroscopic dynamo, And it also could be the atoms have that shape as well, having an axis and a balance and a yin-yang energy where there's a positive and negative within the orb itself. So the Earth has magnetic fields which are circulating around, and NASA has been researching this intensely since the early 50s. It was discovered, the magnetic field of the Earth was discovered first by Christian Birkeland in Sweden, who was a radical inventor. And he was studying the aurora borealis, you know, which people have been seeing forever up in the Arctic area. And he was wondering what makes it. And so he invented a orb in his laboratory that would actually simulate the Earth's magnetic field and create lights at the top of the orb where the light, where the energy goes into the pole from around the Earth. In other words, the energy circulates from the south to the north. This is standard astrophysics. Circulates from the south pole up and out and around and down and in to the north pole.
Mm-hmm.
And when it goes down...
Lines.
Pardon?
Creating flux lines around the outside.
Yes, absolutely. And right. So this happens... Hello? This happens at the micro level and the macro level of space. In other words, at the microscopic level of cells and microbes and so on. And DNA is also a spiral, and it's all spiraling. So all the radiation and magnetism is spiraling. It's interpenetrating. In other words, many, many waves or vibrations fields are going simultaneously in all directions. It's astounding how many, like the radio waves and the internet, how many waves can go simultaneously through a wire or through space in the same space. It's all interpenetrating. It's astounding. So that's the magnetic field. And the gyroscope is when it spins around, it balances. And they actually invented the gyroscope, I don't know, 100 years ago or something, to go with airplanes and to balance devices, vehicles, rockets, and so on, that we need to keep balance in the magnetic field. So whenever you spin something, like a bicycle wheel or turbines are a big thing. All this electricity we're using right now is generated by spinning turbines. And they generate a magnetic field, and all currents generate a magnetic field in the direction of the current, like electric wires and rivers. My theory is that rivers generate a very passive, gentle magnetic field around the river as it flows toward the sea. And that's one of the things that attracts people to the river's edge, because right now millions of people are hanging out in the river, on the shorelines of the rivers, because the rivers generate this very peaceful magnetic flow down there, except then around waterfalls where it's very exciting. In other words, the energy is generated up rather than in a nice flowing current. This water current was discovered by Victor Schauberger in the 1920s when he was a forester in Austria, and he was out in the forest, you know, 8, 10, 12 hours a day, and he just started meditating on water flow and seeing the mysteries of the water and saw spirals in water. Well, before that, the only person that we know of that saw water spiraling was Da Vinci, and he actually drew them. He drew spirals and water currents. They're not painted. It's just nice drawing.
I seem to recall a dynamo experiment where they draped a wire through a river, and as the river passed by over the wire, the magnetic flow of that created a current flow in the wire.
That would not surprise me. That fits in with the implosion theory, that whenever you spiral something, it creates a current within and without it. It generates a larger field, but we don't see it, see? So you actually have to meditate on these things to be able to see them or feel them in your body.
Mm-hmm.
My theory is that qi, the ancient energy of China, qi kung and tai chi and acupuncture and all that, mm-hmm. is actually magnetic. And the first guy to discover that, at least in Western science, is Robert Becker, who did cross currents and the body electric. He was a medical doctor and did a lot of, I don't know, a decade or whatever, of lab science on this, and he reports it in his books. And he reports that when you have an acupuncture needle going to a body, it generates a magnetic field around it. So
the
qi is magnetic.
One of my friends is Dr. Nick Begich, and... electronically, they went around measuring the resistance on the human body with a probe,
yeah.
and they mapped it. And
yeah.
one day, a person familiar with acupuncture walked into the office, looked up at the chart, and said, "Hey, why do you have an acupuncture chart up there?" And he said, "That's not an acupuncture chart. That's a chart of the resistances of the human body." So it was amazing how those two things lined up. My real curiosity is, how did the Chinese, the ancient Chinese, with no electronic equipment whatsoever, identify these points on the body?
I think it's pretty easy myself. I've been doing Qi Kung for about 15 years.
Uh-huh.
So once you get sensitive, you can feel where energy flows in your body.
Uh-huh.
And you can feel where it blocks. If you get a pain or tension in your body, it is a blockage of the flow. And if you test it very much, the Chinese, the sensitive Chinese, we would call them Qi Kung masters, and there's thousands of them over there. I got a video on Qi Kung in China in the 90s when I was starting to practice, and there was 3,000 or 4,000 schools of Qi Kung. Now, if you consider acupuncture a specialized healing dimension of Qi Kung, then that might mean 3,000 or 4,000 clinics of acupuncture. I'm not sure, because the Chinese have strange ways of defining everything. Everything they their entire language is two syllables only.
Really?
They have 214 sounds, and then they have the two syllables. So everything is Qi Kung, Chop Sui, Kung Fu. It's all like that. Peking, Shanghai, all two syllables. I mean, the entire language. Our language is so specialized and so redundant and laced with phony grammar, you know, silent word letters and all that stuff. Our language is really bad. And their language also, their writing goes vertical and doesn't go horizontal. They have an empire thing, but their language, their culture is much more natural, except for when you go in the cities where it's all, you know, technology's invaded.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why the communist revolution, and I'm not speaking about the politics now, was very land-based and people-oriented and cooperative. They had more cooperatives when they peaked in the 60s and 70s than any country has ever had in the world. Cooperatives, people democratically running their businesses, their farms, and that sort of thing.
You know, Marco Polo, when he explored his way to China, he went up the river, and he was just literally blown away by the scope of the architecture and the incredible logic and passion with which everything was built. And when he returned, he had this to say. He said, "Thank God they're not warlike."
Yeah, well, that's true in a way. That comes and goes. So, see, whatever you say about the Chinese today may not be true tomorrow or in 10 years. Because,
well, I know, but Marco Polo found them to be an amazingly artistic and peaceful people, and he noticed that their technology was so far above what quote Western modern society was. He was thankful that they weren't warlike, because they would have just come out and had them for lunch.
Well, it's kind of typical of the Western attitude, thinking of the brilliance of the Chinese in terms of war and economics, when I think of it in terms of nature and cooperation. I mean, I recognize that they killed a lot of people during the revolution, I don't know, 20, 30 million people, whatever. But the amount of cooperation, see, since our society is built on competition, then which stems back from the empires of Europe and so on, or actually could even go back to Egypt and the Romans and the Greeks. Yeah, they were much more competitive also. So we don't really know what we're seeing when we see cooperation. And we see people doing things like the Chinese will do, they'll have 500 or 1,000 people go out and harvest. And they have these, in their villages, their communes, you know, it could be a few thousand people in the village or in the commune. They have these giant biomass factories or whatever, where they take all their compost or a lot of their compost and they biomass compost it together and get biogas, or what we call methane, and then they generate power, heat, and electricity from that. So it's a self-contained sort of valley bioregion-oriented energy system.
We were talking about magnetism and the flow through south to north poles.
Yeah.
Is there a network of lines of energy around planet Earth?
Yeah, there's Well, there's three that I can relate to. One is the ley lines of England, and those have been probably studied more than any place on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And they've actually been, it's called radionics, it's a science. Usually radionics is done with dowsing.
Right.
Because it's a local thing, and you can just do it at home or in your bioregion or your valley, your mountains, whatever. But then if you go bigger, which the English, you know, their empire thing is bigger. And in fact, England was the seat of the Roman Empire for a while. I'm not sure exactly when, but it was. So the English have these ley lines, and what they are is they're the connections of all the megaliths and temples or cathedrals.
Right.
So those are bioregional. So you got dowsing, which is very local. You do it with your hands and, you know, your sensitivity. And we were much more sensitive. Humans were much more sensitive in past ages. That doesn't mean always and everywhere. It just means in certain past ages, people were more sensitive, building megaliths and pyramids and all these things that they did without technology that we know. So
do you think modern man has lost the ability to hear the earth?
To feel it, oh yeah. Now, you can get it back by doing Qigong and massage and healing.
Uh-huh.
But and natural living and living outdoors, which I've been doing for 25 years. But that doesn't mean that anybody can learn it. I'm obsessed. I'm inspired by nature and so on. So, you know, you have to, it's a calling. It's a spiritual calling, whether it's healing or creative, you know, arts and crafts. You're inspired by it. Isn't there something? Well, I think I'm going to try painting now, you know. It's like, well, they have painting schools in college, but how many people are inspired? Do something new. Something beautiful. It's infinite, you know, the infinite creativity of the spirit and humans. So anyway, back to magnetic fields. So in England, in the last 10 years, a guy published a book called Ley Lines on Earth Energy. His name is Arnold and Cohen, I believe the authors. And it's a brilliant book. It's fully illustrated. And he spent 20 years walking the ley lines in England, the hills of mostly Scotland. 20 years, he said he walked 3,000 miles with a dowsing rod, dowsing these lines.
Really?
Well, people have done that in, you know, and here and there, but they've never spent, you know, most of their adult life walking these, and in the winter and everything. So he found the connections between the water holes, the megaliths, the graves, the stone buildings, the mountaintops, the lakes, and so on. He found the connections between them with the magnetic flow. There's something weird. England has a lot of very strange rock formations, which I don't know much about. I just get reports. You know, that they're all connected in a bioregion. There's a magnetic flow that he followed with his dowsing rods. He would walk the magnetic lines. And you can see them connected, but that isn't really what he was interested in. Seeing this is... Just because you can see from one mountaintop or megalith to another doesn't mean that you can feel the vibes flowing between them. But apparently they're snaking vibes of magnetism, and he has these wonderful drawings and paintings. It's astounding. He discovered a lot of things in the megaliths that no one had in the modern times has told about. Now, a few people might know about it, but it's usually secret, so they don't like to tell. The British have a lot of secrets they don't want to tell.
So
we just don't know what they are. But he published a book, and he caught some flack from the Men in Black on that. I don't know exactly what they did, but they tried to cover it up and stuff. It was published in the States. Couldn't publish in England, I guess, because there's too much control over there, you know.
Has anyone gone through the effort to try to link up different ley line maps or energy grid maps around the world to create kind of a global map?
Yeah, there is one, and it's called Vortex. There's a website that has it. It's called vortexmaps.com, and it's based on the geodesic, what we would call crystalline Earth star is the name of the map, and it's based on Bucky Fuller came up with a map in the 40s called the Dymaxion World Grid Map, and I'm on an interview. And the Dymaxion map was in the 40s, very beautiful colored map. First strange new global map of the world, and it folds to a sphere. Well, actually, it's an icosahedron sphere, and then it folds out flat. It was a brilliant, absolutely genius thing. Well, they remodeled it in the 80s and came up with a new one, which is a more of a refined version. You can find it on vortexmaps.com. And I know the guy's name is Dan Shaw, And I did a workshop with him in Ashland a few years ago. And he's gone. He's around the world to the various vortex places. And there's a vortex near there called the Oregon Vortex, which is probably the most famous vortex that's toured, you know, has tours, you know, go, oh, pay $5-$10 for a tour and stuff. And all these magnetic anomalies exist in this 165-degree circle. And it's been that way for centuries, and they discovered it in the 1800s.
Back the week ending the 20th of last month, I was in Trout Lake, Washington, which is just south of Mount Adams.
Yeah.
And I'm told by the locals there that there's a very powerful vortex associated with that mountain.
Yeah. Well, I've been there. I know James. I've known him for, I think it was 98, 99 when I met him.
And that was an awesome experience.
Yeah. Yeah, it is inspiring, and it does open a lot of consciousness for people that go there. And it opened something for me. I'm not sure what it opened because it was so mysterious. He has a sort of semi-permaculture homestead there.
Uh-huh, right.
And I do permaculture myself. He puts more energy into, or at least when I was there, into communicating with people than with the land.
I got you.
Every day I went and gathered eggs and, you know, and did a little gardening and stuff. And he's, you know, more into the Leo. He's a Leo. And he's more into the Leo, you know, the show and hosting and greeting and communicating and all that. He's really brilliant. He's got a good heart.
Can you share with me a little bit what your experience was like?
There?
Yeah.
Well, I went there to meet people and meditate. I did not go there to see UFOs.
Oh, I understand. But I know I kind of went with an open mind, and I had a non-UFO experience, and I just wondered what yours was like.
See, well, mine was more like that. I'm a camper. I love camping out. I'm camping in a treehouse at the moment, and I have been for months, and I love camping on the ground in the hammock and working in living outdoors and getting dirty and growing things and composting and all that. So I kind of got into the garden and the chickens, and then I would just meditate in my hammock. I hung a hammock. He has a little pond there. Do you see the pond?
Yeah.
Very nice little pond.
It is,
and he has little boats you can kind of go around on and stuff. So I'm more playful than most of the UFO guys.
I'm pretty playful. I don't know.
Well, no, I mean just the ones I met there.
Oh, sure.
So, but I talked to them and I liked them, and I met the guests. You know, it was a conference kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And James has he has a neat show that he puts on, you know, in a talk, and he gives the same talk pretty much. But he's a creative person, and he's got his books and everything. Well, that philosophy I've heard for 10 to 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
So that was nothing new. I wasn't really interested in that. I was interested in the people and the nature and the mountain and the vibes of the river. There's a little river running through there.
Right by the street there.
Yeah. And I would go down there and meditate and get in the stream a little bit. And I'm a nature freak. So I was studying that at the time. About 5 years ago. So I've grown a lot of my awareness of nature since then. So it would, and bliss. So I'd be maybe open. I would be other things there. But he's hosted friends of mine that have gone up there. Some of them see UFOs, some do not. The valley seems to be a really, you know, you got the mountain right there, and then the valley and the river is the bottom of the watershed.
Right.
Or the bioregion. And it's hard. It would be really, okay, I didn't do a magnetic field study up there. I have a three-dimensional compass that I do magnetic field studies with.
Really?
Yeah. And it measures up and down as well as side to side, you know.
And what did you detect from that area south?
Well, there's a strong downflowing current there.
Ah.
And there's anomalies around there. So you go from place to place, the needle changes. It doesn't point the same way all the time.
Wow.
It changes. There's a flat spot. The first time I went there was up at a barter fair. You know what a hippie barter fair is?
No, I'm afraid I don't. I was only there for 4 days, and I really didn't explore much. I just was so mesmerized by the mountain and the people.
Right. Yeah. Well, a barter fair is where people set up their booths and they trade things.
Oh, yeah, I know what a barter fair is. I just didn't know there was one close to that area.
Yeah, there was for, you know, a few years. So I went there, and the field, now this wasn't a mountainous area. It was totally flat, not just nicely flat, totally flat. And I jumped up and down on it, and it would echo.
Oh. Huh.
Now, when I was in Hawaii for 10 years, there's a lot of land over there that has lava tubes.
Uh-huh.
Have you heard of lava tubes?
Sure, yeah. Vertical tubes that freeze in the rock, and sometimes they fill up with oil or gas or even hydrogen sulfide.
Yeah. Well, the lava tubes that I'm more familiar with, and they come in all shapes, by the way, probably infinite variety, are horizontal.
Oh, like underground rivers.
Yeah. And the lava flowed through them for God knows how long, and then it emptied out. It emptied out, and so there's still a hole in there, a tunnel.
Uh-huh.
So if you stand on top of them, but the ones underneath, you know, they're like under the ground, and you jump up and down, you can actually feel the ground vibrate.
Wow.
There are places all on Mount Hood, on most of the volcano mountains, there are places with these, the lava tubes are very close to the surface. So if you jump up and down, you can actually feel them vibrate.
Now, describe to me what a three-dimensional compass is.
Okay. It's, you know what a gimbal is? It's a little axis that goes in two directions.
Yes.
Well, they put them in various astronomy devices and gyroscopes and things like that. Well, this is just a little dinky. I mean, it's very small, like an inch in diameter, that has a needle, regular magnetic needle, that goes up and down and side to side. It's on a double axis thing.
I see. So it will align itself with the flux line,
yeah.
Not just horizontal to the Earth, but whatever azimuth it decides to assume.
Right. It goes with the magnetic waves. Now, the magnetic waves were proposed, 50 years ago, but nobody believed it.
No.
They didn't believe that they're actually magnetic lines. Magnetism was so mysterious, it was like being a fish in water. You know, what is it? I mean, we don't know. We're held here. Thank God we're not flying off into space, though some people want to. Star Trek people, they want to escape the Earth. But so this will measure, like in southern Oregon, the needle goes down, so straight down. In fact, it did that yesterday in downtown Eugene. It went straight down.
Wow.
It was strange. And what I assume from, taking hundreds of readings of this and in Australia and Bali and New Zealand and Peru and the Yucatan and Guatemala and Panama and Nicaragua and Hawaii and around Oregon and in Northern California, that the magnetic field always goes down in the north and up in the south southern hemisphere.
So it doesn't necessarily penetrate the Earth only at the north and south poles. It sort
right.
of weaves itself in and out of the crust.
Exactly. And I was saying about the vortex maps, it's called the Earth Star Map, has 62 magnetic, giant magnetic vortexes that are 500 to 1,000 miles across.
Wow.
And that would, and the biggest one that we know of in that context is the Bermuda Triangle.
How does that magnetism go up or down there?
Well, it goes down.
So into the interior of the Earth.
Yeah. Well, we don't know where it goes. It just goes in. I mean, things disappear there, so we're not really sure where they went, you know?
Mm.
There's a lot of mystery about this. We may know where something is, but we don't know what it's doing.
Mm.
You know, and you go to a mystery spot, and you just get an anomalous experience, which is kind of like these crop circles are created with this geometry, with a similar geometry, that when people go into them or even fly over them in planes, they get these weird experiences that they don't really know what is causing it. Or it's invisible, you know, it's invisible. Some people go in them, they get really high, they get spaced, they get relaxed, they get blissed out, they get sick, they get headaches, they get dizzy, they fall over, you know.
I've heard of people getting nauseous inside of them because of the ELF that's going on there.
Yeah, I would like to see one, but it's too far away. I'd have to spend too much oil to get there.
I know. I'm with you. So can you speculate or have you meditated or imagined what purpose these energy grid lines or these magnetic grid lines serve? What purpose do they serve for the Earth itself? If we believe that the Earth is either an intelligent design or it is a self-designing body that sort of evolves,
yeah,
then these magnetic lines, these energy vortexes and these areas of interest probably have some kind of bio-purpose for the Earth.
Yeah.
Have you ever thought about that?
Oh, yeah. Well, this is where it fits in with Gaia ecology, that each of the power spots, if you take the Earth as a giant crystal, because it has so much minerals inside,
right,
that all the crystals are tetrahedrons at the smallest unit. And we found, in my studies of this, I've been studying clay for about 25 years, using clay and studying it, and mostly for healing and so on.
I see.
And clay, the smallest unit of clay is a silica, and it's a tetrahedron. Well, so is certain carbons, like diamonds and things, mm-hmm. the tetrahedrons.
Mm-hmm.
So tetrahedron was discovered by Buckminster Fuller, I mean, not first discovered, but used by Bucky Fuller for his designs and his buildings. So mm-hmm. the tetrahedron is a, and icosahedron, you know, and the spirals, are all cosmic geometry, and this has been kind of reborn in the late 20th century called sacred geometry. And Dan Winter was one of the discoverers of this, or he's also a promoter. He's more of a spiritual person than he is an architect or anything, where Fuller was more of an architect and not, you know, and spiritual as well, his philosophy and so on. But the geodesic shape of the Earth in the invisible grid is like a geodesic dome.
Hmm.
And each of the hubs, we call them hubs, I build domes sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
We call the points where the struts come together is a hub.
Okay.
Like a hub and a wheel.
Right.
So if you take a wheel and you think of a wheel and it's a mandala, and the hub is the center where it spins around, so it's kind of the axis of the wheel or the gyroscope, then that is a centering place. So if you have, like in the Earth grid power spots, and there's 62 big ones and thousands of small ones, then each of those centers or vortexes is an inflowing or outflowing or balancing power spot. So those are the three basic functions of the centers, inflow, outflow, and balancing.
Hmm. Do you think there's a method of communication that belongs to the Earth with the life living on its surface? I know animals can communicate very well with the Earth, and I know every human isn't genetically endowed with the ability to communicate intimately with the Earth, but in times past, it appears that there have been tribes whose certain members have a strong propensity for that, and consequently are looked up to by the tribe as sort of a early warning device, you know, like when do we get to higher ground or when do we move away from the valley. Do you think that these lines, these points of communication, or these points of magnetism are Earth's way of communicating with life on its surface?
Absolutely. That was very clear. Thank you. The tribes, the natives that we're referring to, they would call them a shaman, but each culture has a different name for the spirit beings or teachers or healers or sensitives. Like we have many names for them. And each tribe that has those kind of people has a name for them. We would just say I'm a chief or a leader or a healer. But a lot of the tribes have forgotten it in this modern age, in the last 200 years of all the revolutions and industry and everything. A lot of the tribes have forgotten it. And the British were very good at going in and conquering a tribe and taking over and banishing their spiritual activities, like drumming. In Africa, drumming and singing in Africa are two of the most powerful and common ways. Dancing, drumming, and singing are the three most common spiritual practices in Africa. And then in the United States, they outlawed drumming and Sundance and other things. The Indians in America were harder to conquer in a way, like some of the tribes in Africa, where in other places the tribes could be conquered and made to go to work. American Indians have really never really wanted to go to work for the white man, but their rituals. Now, those are being revived by the hippies since the 60s, reviving the Native American Indian rituals.
Uh-huh.
One of the main ones is sweat lodges and chanting.
Sure.
And Sundance has even been revived, which I don't know much about. It seems kind of like self-punishment, but I've suffered a lot, so I can kind of appreciate suffering as a way to heal yourself.
I don't know if you heard that crackle, but that was a lightning strike about 20 feet outside my house.
Really?
Yeah, there's a very violent lightning storm going on outside. But,
oh, my God.
I'm deep beneath the earth in my cellar, so I'm safe.
Oh, really? Great. Well, you're safe for a while.
Yeah, I just hope it doesn't kill the power, because that would end this program prematurely. And we
okay, well, if we get cut off, we'll know that it was Gaia doing it.
That's right. That's right. We're here talking about her and trying to protect her, and so I hope she's merciful.
Yeah.
I do know that there was a tribe living in the path of the tsunami of 2005, and they were saved by a shaman who somehow sensed the destruction was coming, and the village, even though it's modern times, who knows what kind of instruments they might have had. They might even have had cell phones, but certainly there was no early warning system except for him. And he said, people, I think you need to gather your things together for this afternoon. We're going up on the mountain because there's going to be a tsunami. And not one person was harmed.
Yeah.
So there are these, you can call them anomalies, you can call them, you know, a lucky break, but I think, my personal opinion, that the earth has a way of issuing forth a pulse when something is out of the ordinary, and those that are attuned to that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the elephants felt that in Asia. A few elephants felt it, and a couple of villages followed the elephants up the hill.
Yeah, wasn't there a little girl on one of those elephants that she was trying to make it go one way, and the elephant said, no, I'm going up here.
Yeah.
And it ended up saving her life.
Yeah. Well, sometimes people get precognition. They can see the flood before it happens, you know, psychically.
Uh-huh.
But other times you would just get a feeling like, well, I just need to get out of here. It, you know, there's some, like, bad vibes. And animals will leave bad vibes. There's this thing called syzygy by Jim Berkland, and he has this thing, animals run away before earthquakes. And he's been tracking it for 20 years or something. And the animals just don't like the vibes, and they leave.
Mm.
And they wouldn't tell you why. They don't know why. They just don't like it. They're going to go. And so that's one of the things that freedom is, that these animals are domesticated animals, but they still have enough of a, some of them have enough of an intuition that they can, instincts that they can just go when the vibes get bad.
Mm. And I guess someone who lived by way of animal, either used them for extra labor or extra force or travel, would become attuned to the habits of that animal and would know, you know what, something's out of the ordinary here, because my elephant never does this before, and I think he means to tell us something.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Well, if you're aware that animals are aware, awareness recognizes itself. Rational minds tend to be kind of specialized and in a bubble.
I like that term, rational. When I was sort of studying psychology when I was in college, I noticed that children were very creative and sometimes blurted out observations that they would make that would be rather aggravating for a, quote, grown-up. And I realized that there was this process of rationality that caused us to forget certain intuitions that we had as kids, because either...
Mommy, why is that lady so fat?
Yeah, something like that. Or I'm hungry now, or we need to get out of this glass shop right now, because I think there's an earthquake coming. I want to ask you, if man disturbs the macro-organic rhythms of nature, will it result in storms or shocks or floods or earthquakes, or does the earth have an allergic reaction to this?
Yeah, the climate crisis is based on the input of energy, which is mostly from the sun and comets and things, but mostly from the sun. And then the need of Gaia to rebalance and keep rebalancing. So like in the sun, we've got this really heavy solar influx, which peaked in the middle 90s, but it didn't go down. Usually it goes up every 11 years to the top and then down for 11 years, then up in 11 years and then down. And it's been doing that for centuries. But there, every century, there's a couple of anomalies where it's weird. Well, this time, there's more energy coming from the sun than there has been for many centuries. And it speeds up everything on Earth. I mean, just imagine you're putting in a tremendous amount of solar energy into the Earth, and it's also heating up these planets as well. The planets are getting hotter. And you can dig for this info in NASA. They kind of hide it. I mean, they publish it, but they hide it at the same time. It's kind of strange.
Right.
But, yeah, the Earth is heating up. So it's heating up and causing all these storms. And now the earthquakes are slower. The earthquakes and the volcanoes erupting are the slowest of the cycles.
Right.
Like the drought, for example. I've been experiencing what is a very slow 50-year drought here in the Northwest. And occasionally we get storms. We've had two big floods in the Willamette Valley, one in the 60s, one in the 90s. So you get more and more dry and then bigger and bigger storms.
Hmm.
And it's still rebalancing. But see, humans, the civilized people, have lost their natural balance, so they don't even relate to the concept of balance. If you look in science and you try to find balance in science, you just go in any of the sciences, geology, biology, anything, balance is almost completely omitted.
Well, we live on balance in the world of chemistry, but I see what you're saying. If it gets hot, we just turn the air conditioning on. If it gets dark, we just turn lights on. If it gets wet, we just go inside. We don't feel, we're not sensitive to the variations in our environment.
Yeah, and it's called equilibrium in science. And I was mentioning spirals. It's called convections in science, but it's a very small concept. In Gaia, Lovelock calls it equilibrium, or symbiosis, or self-regulation.
Yeah.
But it's balancing is another word for all that.
Well, a lot of people think that, and I'm not saying that you're this way, but I have met environmentalists who really believe that the Earth would find some permanent stasis, some point of perfect blissful balance if only man wasn't here.
Oh. Well, idealism has any forms. Fantasies, you know, are rampant.
Right.
Heaven, you know, if you have heaven on Earth, drive-in utopia, technology paradise, all that kind of stuff.
You say on your websites, which by the way, do you have a website that can sort of lead to everything that you've got?
It's called eCosma, E-C-O-Z-M-A.
Let me write that down.
E-C-O-Z-M-A.
eCosma. eCosma.com?
No, it's actually, you just go in eCosma, it'll come up. There's nobody else that does eCosma.
Okay.
But then there's another site that's connected to that, it's directly connected, and there are two sites. And the other one's Sunergy, S-U-N-E-R-G-Y.
Right.
Yeah, so those two sites are connected, and there's about 20 books on each one.
Oh, I know. There's so much information. We could spend days and days talking with Michael Sunanda. And on one of your many information pieces that you have, you say that we are nearing the sixth great extinction.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Well, you know who Richard Leakey is?
Yes.
Well, his dad discovered the first, in the West, first discovery of ancient skulls, 2 million, 3 million years old. It's hard to know how far back it goes, but
right.
They discovered the first really ancient human skulls in the West. Because I take everything in the West as kind of a newbie on the block. Asia is so far, and Africa and Australia is so far beyond our concepts of history that it's, anyway. So he discovered them. Then his son, Richard Leakey, wrote a book in the 90s called The Sixth Extinction, which is what we're in right now. And because we are so unnatural, the city people are so unnatural, we don't really have a long span of time. All the in the age of Pisces, it was all fables and stories and proverbs and all that stuff. Now we just have movies and TVs and books and radios and video games and stuff that replaced all the old ancient legends and stuff. We even call them urban legends. So this book is about how all these species are dying, and it's been about a 50-year trend where there's been a rapid acceleration. This, by the way, does parallel the oil peak oil and global warming crisis. It parallels it perfectly.
Right.
The animals are dying. Some of them are going extinct, and there's still new ones coming up. So, and that's going to continue, but every year it's different. So they're saying now that thousands of species have gone extinct in the 20th century.
Sure. Well, we've had species go extinct in other centuries too, and some of it because of the blooming of one bacteria or another, or a cosmic storm, or the rerouting of a river. It just depends on how big the biosphere is in which that that species exists, and what the biodiversity is in that gene pool. In other words, is there enough genetic variation for a Darwinian adaptation so that there's some kind of, you can call it evolution if you want to, but it could be natural selection. Something can have a survivable advantage. But if the change happens too sudden or it's outside that genetic capability, then that species is going to go extinct, whether it's dinosaurs or cherry trees.
Yeah. Well, I would agree, and it's I don't use the Darwin language anymore because I find it too archaic. The mutations occur constantly in various places where there are extreme ecology. I call them ecospasms.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And they cause mutations, but mutations are only caused during certain cycles: pregnancy, conception, pregnancy, and bonding cycle, which is
right.
When the baby, and this is at any size, whether it's microbe or elephant, when the baby is growing and still bonded to the mother, its cells are still making the organs, so it's subject to mutation. So I was born, I had really a bad liver and bones, my face and everything, and then I had no cavities until I was 16. Which is, there was the only person in the neighbor, you know, in a couple thousand kids that had no cavities. And then my teeth went to shit, and it got holes, and they still have holes in them. And I lost a lot of teeth because of all the sugar. So that's very common.
Right, right.
I mean, not that the cavities are common, and the sugar is common, and losing teeth and dentures and all that is common.
Hmm.
And it's normal in our, but if you go to the cultures where they don't have sugar, they still have their teeth.
Yeah, they sure do. And they eat stuff with a lot of grit in it, too, and their teeth still manage to survive.
Yeah. Well, I eat a lot. I had years of chips and nuts, and my teeth just went away. They just cracked and broke.
Yeah. I know what that's like. Well, we got started a few minutes late, but my very special guest is Michael Sunanda. Great intellect, and I'm sure this first hour flew by. I can't believe we're through already. But we will be right back with our great guest, and we want you to look up his website, and we want you to be part of the show. So we'll give you some numbers and ways to communicate with us when we get back.
So how long we got to go?
We got 2 hours.
Two more hours.
If you want to stay, and we'll be back in about 6.5 minutes.
Good. Thank you. Bye.
Did you know you have existed for many thousands of years? The thought of reincarnation escapes most people, as it did me until I read this book. Your Never-Ending Life is the first in the Universal Learning Series from Sandy Andrew. Search your higher mind, find your soulmate, and know that you are never alone in this world. The treasures of the eternities are yours, and your first step is to read the book. Click the banner for Your Never-Ending Life by Sandy Andrew at X Squared Radio and order the book today. There is something about to happen to the Earth. You know it. You can feel it. Well, the creators of the Kill Shot have collected the evidence for you in a stunning new documentary called The Horizon Project. The first DVD is now in print, and you can get it by clicking on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio. Believe me when I tell you, this may be the most important video production you will ever see. This is destined to air on the Discovery Channel or the History Channel, but you need the uncut version. Click the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio and get your copy today. Many people write us here at X Squared Radio wanting to know how to get prepared for the coming cataclysms. Well, we have been successful in acquiring the best affiliate in the world for emergency preparedness. NitroPak has been around for 18 years and can provide everything you need for life. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a year's supply of excellent quality foods and supplements for a single person or a whole family. Don't be left without the essentials of life. NitroPak is the name. Click the banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and the Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysm? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two of the series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com and get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version.
Hello?
This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Welcome back, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. My special guest tonight is Michael Sunanda. If you want to communicate with us tonight during the show, if you're in the United States, you can call us toll-free at 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. If you're in Canada and you want to call us, you can do so toll-free at 888-810-8255. 8322. And if you're anywhere else on the planet, or even off-planet, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can reach us at 530-876-3222. And if you will go to AOL Instant Message, that's AIM, you can do a search for my username, which is Vision Officer, and you can send me instant messages during the program. I have several listeners that do that, and we will get those to you. Just as a reminder, you may have noticed, if you're trying to listen to the archives of X-Squared Radio, that there is a very small subscription fee now of $2.50 if you want to listen for 30 days. And of course, you can just about listen to all of about 160 hours of content there for $2.50 if you like, or you can get a year's subscription for less than $2 a month, about $20 for a whole year. We would like you to sign up for that subscription so that we can keep making the bills and keep bringing you this program and maybe even expand to more evenings each week. My guests' websites can be found by doing a search on the words Sunergy, that's S-U-N-E-R-G-Y, or Ecosma, E-C-O-Z-M-A. I promise you'll do many days of reading, as I have done, to try to come up to speed with all of the research this man has done. And we're very delighted to have him on the program tonight. I did have a way to start off this second hour. I wanted to maybe cross into the interaction of not just this present civilization, but maybe past civilizations with the Earth, and see if we can find a link to perhaps stable ecologies that were lived in the past. And maybe explore the possibility of multiple civilizations existing, not only in the past, but possibly in the present on the Earth. So my question to you is, how many major civilizations, in your opinion, have existed on the Earth and maybe reached their zenith and then passed away? Did we lose our guest? Well, I guess I make an appeal to my producer now to see if he can get Mr. Sunanda back on the line. We have had a pretty violent electrical storm the last 20 or 30 minutes here in western Kentucky. We may have lost our contact, but until we get that back, I guess I can go with it solo for a few moments. We have been talking about the ecology of the Earth, and I don't think anyone will disagree that there's not been a fair amount of politics about this subject. Certainly, movies have been produced and books have been written, and even public policy has been bantered about as though they're really going to get serious about doing something just in response to the public pressure and maybe even governmental pressure of bodies like the UN or treaties that have been put together like the Kyoto Accord to try to get something to move off top dead center with respect to environmental concerns. That being said, I have to say that being born and raised in Los Angeles, I left there when I was 17, but I've certainly been back several times on business. Growing up, I remember the sky being brown. By afternoon, it was just hardly fit to breathe. Living in the San Gabriel Valley, looking west toward Los Angeles was impossible. It was just a brown haze all the way. Now, this was back in the late 50s, early 60s, and now you can go to the San Gabriel Mountains and you can look west and you can see a long, long way, even though there are about 12 times as many vehicles. That is in as a direct result of the catalytic converter technology, better fuels, more efficient fuel mixture management through fuel injection and fuel management systems. All of this is having its effect, and I would like to say that the state of California has probably led the world with its restrictions on emissions. And because of its great car-buying population, through those that discrimination and that legislation, they have exerted great pressure on the automobile industry. Years past, you used to be able to get one car model in, say, Nevada, but if a car was going to be shipped to California, it had extra controls on it. Now, those environmental concerns, those laws, those results that we've seen from that great technology have had their effect. And now all states and even all countries have benefited from the pressure, the environmental concerns that the people of California have placed upon the world. Being the 11th largest economy in the world, California has had their influence. And I, for one, appreciate it. It's done a lot to help the ecology. Now, the other thing is, if you go way east, say, to the Smoky Mountains, and you should happen to hike up to, well, let's say Mount LeConte, 6,500 feet. Once you get to about 4,000 feet above sea level in the Smoky Mountains, you notice something has happened to the trees. No, that's not blight, it's not beetles, it's not anything biological. That's the result of acid rain. Acid rain. These are pollutants that get into the air, they rise up into the clouds, they mix with water, change the pH of the water, and then rain down on the earth. Instead of being nice and clean and distilled and neutral at 7 pH, it's slightly lower than that, somewhere around 5.5. When it rains onto the ground, if the ground happens to be limestone or have a lot of calcium in it, there's a neutralizing effect, but it hits the trees first, and the trees don't have a way to neutralize that except to die. And so you see thousands and thousands of acres above about 4,500 feet in the Smoky Mountains damaged by the industry that operates west of that area, sends those pollutants up into the sky, it mixes with water, it rains back down on those mountains. And it is a terrible sight to see. So there is an effect on the earth by the activities of man, and it's not something that earth is going to bounce back easily from. And maybe we need the same kinds of pressures on industries now that we had back in the 60s and 70s and 80s to try to get these emissions under control so that that doesn't happen again. If my producer is out there, perhaps he can see if he can get Michael Sunanda back on the line. And
okay, I'm right here. Did we lose somebody?
Yeah, I think either we lost the connection or misunderstood that Michael Merkel was going to
Aha, well, let's get him back on the air. Stay with me.
Okay, not a problem.
Hello?
All right, we're back. Sorry.
Oh, Brooks, hi, I can barely hear you.
Sorry we lost the connection there.
Yeah, I changed phones, but here we are.
All right, that's great. No problem. We weathered the commercials and intro just fine. In the second hour, I would like to discuss the possibilities of perhaps multiple civilizations having existed in the past, and maybe currently we're just not aware of them. I wanted to ask you if you had any ideas or feelings how many major civilizations might have existed on the earth and maybe reached their zenith and passed away.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, I wanted to just finish a pattern I started before. It's about the earth grids, and then I'll
sure,
go to civilizations.
Sure, yeah.
The most famous is called 19.5, and Richard Hoagland mentions it quite often on Mars and Jupiter and the Earth. And there's five vortexes on Earth that are at 19.5, that is latitude above the equator. One is Big Island, Hawaii, the Devil's Triangle or the Dragon's Triangle in south of Japan, the Afghanistan, the northwestern part of the Sahara Desert, which borders on Morocco, the Bermuda Triangle, and Big Island, Hawaii. Those are five of the biggest power spots in the northern hemisphere, and they work. Each one is a little different than each other.
Wow, what the local people that live there and sort of, maybe they are not used to it, but maybe they are more sensitive to it. and maybe it's why their ancestors moved there in the first place. What do they say about these areas?
Well, I can just tell you about Big Island because it's the only one that I've really been to.
Okay.
And I lived there for 10 years. And we visited the volcano a lot, and where it's going to the sea, it's red hot, and going to the sea, it's very strong. And then also it's, well, there's the crater where Kilauea, the currently active volcano, is the crater.
Uh-huh.
But then there's two other dormant volcanoes on the island. I mean, they're dormant, they're venting. Mauna Loa, Mauna Kea, and Kilauea are the three volcanoes on Big Island. It's the biggest island, and it's got the most volcanoes on it. It's the most active volcano.
Mm-hmm.
So the local people aren't really into the Earth grid at large. They're just into the local one. And they respect it as the power of the Earth. It's Earth power, and it's called Pele.
I see.
So they've attached a goddess to it, the name of the goddess Pele. And they've attached that name. And they go up there, and they do rituals, and they make they take gifts to Pele, and there's ancient rituals about Pele as a ghost or a spirit that appears here and there, and it will surprise people or scare people or bless people or whatever. Everybody gets a different hit off of it. And that's the thing with the spirits around Earth anyway, is that each person has their own experience. So it's like, well, this is a good spirit, this is a bad spirit, this is an evil spirit, this is a holy spirit. It's not that way. Each person gets their own experience.
I see. Well, do they manifest that in their art, or do they?
Oh, there's a lot of Pele art on Big Island. A lot.
How does it manifest in terms of religion?
Well, it really is just a nature, kind of a underground nature religion. Because, you know, there's lots of Christians and Catholics and Buddhists, because there's a lot of Orientals in Hawaii, a lot of Asian, Japanese, and Filipino, and
uh-huh.
some Chinese, and so on. And there's a lot of those different things. So Hawaii is really the mixing pot. We used to say that the San Francisco and New York were the mixing pot. Well, that's the East Coast, the West Coast. But Hawaii is really the mixing pot with Asia. And so there's thousands of Japanese, and the Hawaiians, and the white people, and the black people, and the hippies, and all that stuff.
But how does the local religion respond to that much life energy in that area?
If you mean religion by churches,
uh-huh.
they ignore it.
Really?
Well, there is an exception, and there's always exceptions to these patterns and these trends and stuff, that there's an ancient hangover from the old Hawaiian culture. And they were an empire. They had the most evolved language, non-written language, of any culture in the world. And it's been translated into dictionaries and stuff for Hawaiians.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So they were extremely ritualized. And when the white men came, Captain Cook and company came to Hawaii, they were dazzled by the extraordinary social levels, class system, control, language, marketing, money, empire, war, all this stuff. All this stuff of empires was happening there, but small. So the power of the island is very strong because there's so much volcanoes under there. There's probably, let's see, I'm trying to think if there's more live volcanoes there than anywhere in the Northern Hemisphere. There's a lot in Italy. That's the only place I know in the Northern. Well, actually, in Central America, there's a lot, too. A lot of really hot volcanoes, and they explode down there. We haven't had a really big explosion on Big Island since 1960.
Well, I think some of those volcanoes could be... they couldn't be too dormant for me.
Too what?
They could not be too dormant for me.
For you?
Yeah, I don't think I'd be comfortable living on an island where volcanoes are venting all the time.
Well, if you, in order to know how you would feel, you kind of have to go there and visit them, and then your experience will tell you how you feel. You're just thinking about it right now?
Yeah, I'm just thinking about it, but I do want to go to Hawaii someday, and I don't want to go, you know, typically as a tourist and sit on the beach. I want to go visit this specifically because that is one of the main focuses of life energy on the Earth.
Yeah, it is. It is. Well, I would tour you there. I've toured a lot of people there. Well, I wasn't a big tour guy, but I toured friends, and one woman, I went down, the first time I went down to the ocean where it's going into the sea, right as we speak, it's going into the sea and it's blowing
right.
up. a mile-high cloud of steam up in
wow.
gases into the sky and stuff. You can't really be downwind from it. It'll kill you, but the gases, the breathing, the gases and stuff. But we can be upwind, and that's pretty easy. You know, upwind, downwind, you can feel that. So we hiked down across the lava field. Well, it made a huge lava field. It's probably 5 square miles by now of new land. And I don't know how much, really, but that's about 5 square miles of land. And it's still building land. It builds it out, and it keeps going out and out further. Well, the volcano used to have, it has a big crater, but it's dormant at the crater, but it's going out the side of the mountain and down into the sea. You walk across the volcano, the lava field, which is about a mile where we were, about a mile, or maybe it was only half a mile, but it's all this, like, very crystally, jaggedy, up and down, some trails and where people go and stuff. And we went down right to where it was going into the sea, and you could see it, you could smell it, you could feel the heat. You could even feel the heat in the ground. Some people are crazy, and they walk up right on it, and it melts their shoes and stuff.
Oh, my goodness.
There's a lot of crazies over there.
Well, I think I would rather go with a tour guide. So if you're open-minded, when I get ready to go, I'll call you up and see if you'll go with me and be my tour guide. That way I won't waste a lot of time with the touristy crap.
Yeah, the last time we went down there, we went on a full moon, and there was nobody else there, and we were astounded. I mean, sometimes there's hundreds of people down there. But it must have been a powerful night, or I'm not sure what, but we had the whole thing to ourselves. And the lava formations that have closed down them and comes out and freezes are the most beautiful, crystally, spirally, spiny ice-looking things you've ever seen. It's just dazzling, the shapes of the lava.
That sounds
And it's become a cultural artifact or a crafts where people collect the rocks, they make rock walls, they make fireplaces and all kinds of stuff. It's just astounding the amount of things you can make out of the lava. And there's tubes. You can go through tours in the lava tubes and take caves.
Oh, wow. Are the tubes still hot?
No. These are very ancient tubes. They haven't been dry for hundreds of years. Well, actually, some of them have water in them, but not usually.
Wow.
Usually the water in Hawaii, when it rains a lot, it goes right into the ground. It soaks in instantly or it evaporates. So it rains in an hour, it's all gone.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a very strong ecosystem. And it's a 19.5, and there's some people that say that the Kilauea crater is the center of consciousness of the northern hemisphere and things like that. You know how the New Agers like to generalize about these things. Yes, this is the center of the universe. And, I mean, it is true that the Big Island Hawaii or the Hawaiian Islands are the biggest, are the most far from the continents of any inhabited land on Earth. We're in the middle of the biggest ocean in the solar system.
Wow. Well, I agree with that there's no liquid water anywhere else in our solar system, and Hawaii certainly sits in the middle of the biggest body of water in for probably 12 light years in any direction.
Yeah, that's right. It's very cosmic, but most people aren't. In fact, Hawaii doesn't really have very many cosmic people, and there are some UFOs up here there now, but I've never seen one.
Huh.
I live half a mile from where the lava was flowing down to the down to the ocean. I could see it at night, red hot. And then I went back a year later there, and it was gone. It was covered up. Thing was covered.
Do you think the UFOs that come there, do they come up out of the sea and visit the island and then go back under the sea?
Well, it's all speculation to me. I have no idea.
Well, I was going to ask you about the multiple civilizations that may have lived and passed away on this planet.
Right.
And maybe have in the past reached some kind of balance or agreement with the planet that they gave back what they used, or they lived in balance without burning things. Do you have a feeling for that?
Yeah. I studied cataclysmic evolution for 10 years, and that's not Darwin. Darwin actually denied cataclysms. And what happened with the cataclysms is that every empire, now this isn't to say ancient civilizations, because not all ancient civilizations have been killed, destroyed, but most of them have. But the empires have come and gone. And the empires that we know that have come and gone are the Egyptian, or actually the Phoenician, the Sumerian, the Egyptian, the Greek, and the Roman empires. And then you can see after the empires, the relics of the empires, like each empire is then destroyed by nature or conquered by another empire. And you can see those. So we have tracks in the West. Now remember, the East is a completely different story as far as their empire thing, their history. But we have five empires in here now. Well, the American Empire is, I call it the USUK Empire, the US-UK Empire. And that is just a current thing. And we think we're more superior to all the other empires. So we have the greatest technology. But there's millions of things that happened on Earth that we can't explain with our science. So they were advanced beyond us. Each empire gets advanced in some way from what they remember. And then they, like the Mayans, they had a drought, 40-year drought. The one in the southwest in New Mexico, New Mexico and Arizona, I forgot their name, it's an Indian tribe, and they disappeared. And we finally figured it took a couple centuries of noticing their relics and their artifacts to figure out that it's a drought that got them too. So it seems to be drought in the northern hemisphere is fairly common every century or few centuries. A big drought comes and that wipes out whatever empire. It doesn't wipe out the natives because they're integrated with nature and they can prepare and they can see it coming and so on. But the city people just don't. We become very narrow. We think of, well, I got a week's worth of groceries and I have
if that
bills at the end of the month, and they don't know beyond that. And if you want to know beyond that, you join a company that has a 5-year plan or something.
Yeah, I rarely see the 5-year plan come to fruition. I have worked for many. Do you think that there are advanced civilizations living on the Earth now that aren't integrated with
our civilization? You mean invisible-like?
Well, either invisible.
You gotta yell, there's an airplane coming over.
Slightly out of sight, there could be whole civilizations living on the floor of the ocean. We wouldn't know it.
I don't know if there are other civilizations. I mean, to me, the invisible, well, the Russians are, well, they kind of fragmented, but Chinese are definitely an empire. The Americans,
right.
And there's the Catholics and the Muslims, and yeah, there's a lot of empires right now.
What about the interior of the Earth? The interior of the Earth?
I have a different take on the hollow Earth. There is that theory that there's civilizations inside the hollow Earth, and maybe even UFOs, which the spirit has not told me about this. You know, I get intuitions about many things, but that's one thing I haven't really. I just hear New Age information. I was on the Hollow Earth website, email group for a while, but I dropped out because they were so redundant. They just kept saying the same thing over and over and over again.
I dropped out as well.
Yeah, it gets boring. And if it's all speculation or 90% speculation, then and you have to see a UFO or be abducted by one to get it, then I'm not interested, even if they are in there.
You know, I feel exactly the same way. That's why we have mounted the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition. We're going to go and see.
I heard of your thing. Yeah, I read about it.
Yeah, we're not going to speculate anymore. We're not going to capitalize on faulty geology or New Age rumors or UFOs or spirits or orbs or anything else. Although all that's interesting, we're going to get on a boat and we're going to go up there and we're going to measure and we're going to see.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've been hearing plans on that for about 3 years now.
Yes, unfortunately, the leader of that, Steve Curry, just recently, really recently, like 4 weeks ago, died of brain cancer. So that effort kind of spiraled into the same kind of ill health that he was suffering. But since that time, the group that has originally put together the funds to do it didn't have enough funds to get it completely done, so they've agreed to allow me to lead the expedition. So now I find myself leading the group, and we're putting together some financial instruments to make sure that the expedition takes place and that those that would be interested in the data that we might collect and would certainly profit from that data might be willing to donate to the cause in a tax-deductible way, so that we can make the expedition happen.
Uh-huh. Well, that's way beyond me. I'm a hardcore hippie, but what I wanted to do was tell you about my theory about the inner Earth.
Yes, please.
They've been saying that there's an inner sun in there. And I, being an energy person, and I've been working on the EAT theory, energy awareness theory, since 72, when I kind of got inspired about it when Bucky Fuller was coming here.
Right.
That there is a spiraling vortex inside the Earth that's generating the axis rotational gyroscope and is generating magnetic field around the Earth, and it generates energy that makes lava.
That's very interesting. How does that spiraling vortex work? What does it spiral around?
Well, there's every gyroscope, every spinning orb, and you can, you know, you have your little gyroscope toys and you can spin a ball and so on. Things spin, you know. If they're round and they're kind of halfway balanced inside, even eggs will spin. Then they'll spin on an axis. But if they're not very balanced, they will wobble and fall or whatever. And that also explains a little bit about the Earth wobble. I mean, the Earth wobble is like the Earth, like if you ever seen a gyroscope spinning on a flat thing, and
sure.
It will wobble a little bit?
Mm-hmm.
Well, my theory is, and this probably isn't my theory, it's probably just physics, that the wobble is actually helps the thing stay spinning. It kind of keeps it from falling over. But anyway, so get back to the vortex thing. So the magnetic field is going from the south to the north. It goes way out, thousands of miles out, and it goes in. And that magnetic field is actually impacted or blasted by the sun. And it's called the shock bow and the magnetosphere and the tail spin and these different things about what the sun does to the magnetic field as the Earth turns in the solar wind. And there's lots of graphics on the web about that from NASA and so on. Okay, and they do include spirals in there. They don't like to talk much about it because it's a little too cosmic for everything spiraling. So my theory is that inside the Earth there's a vortex of all this cosmic energy that's coming in through the poles, mostly the North Pole, coming mostly out through the South Pole. And it goes in there, and this fits with astrophysics, even though they don't like to go into the inner Earth. They just say there's a nuke in there, a nuclear bomb, a nuclear power plant, factory inside the Earth. Well, I think that's like saying that the Big Bang is the nuclear reaction of the origin of the universe. It's just pure speculation, and it's very egotistical, kind of like building the Empire State Building or something is really big. Well, the Empire, the universe, the sun, the Earth, everything is nuclear power. You know, it's big ego stuff, science. So, if this is true, the magnetic field is going inside the Earth, it's spinning a vortex, and in the core, it reverses the field. That is, a spiral, if you take a spiral in the center, it will reverse the spin, but it will kind of, it goes in the top and comes out the bottom, and in the center it reverses and spins more intensely. So if this is true, then it's making lava inside the Earth, and the expanding Earth people, which I believe in, say that the E equals MC squared is being reversed in there, and so it's the Earth vortex is making land, making matter out of radiation. And the way that the nuclear science physics people say is that matter makes radiation. Well, the atomic bomb, they use that as an example to prove that, but they don't use nature as an example to prove any of this stuff. They ignore nature, like it doesn't exist at the moment.
Well, yes, they ignore nature, but the theory was that if you can force matter beyond its natural state to a point of super density, in other words, take uranium and enrich it by slamming extra neutrons into it, like...
I know, but that's man-made thing.
It's man-made.
It's been 100 years. Nature was going long before man and long before nuclear physics. So let's ignore nature while we invent a new source of energy. Ha ha ha. To me, it's comedy. Science is comedy.
You know what would happen to the macroeconomic engine of capitalism if new, free, pollution-free, easy-to-obtain energy became available to underdeveloped countries in this world, right?
Well, I don't care about that. What I'm more interested in is Qigong, and you can get free energy by doing Qigong. but as far as free energy for macroeconomic systems and big scale technology, I don't care about that. I feel that the peak oil thing and the global warming and the climate crisis are all connected, but free energy is something that animals and microbes and humans can absorb from nature, doing qigong and yoga and other kinds of aerobic things. Natives have been doing it forever. So, you know, it's a different, it's a matter of scale.
It's a matter of scale, but yeah. It doesn't take, you know, a rocket scientist to figure out that the amount of civilization that a natural energy source can support, whether it's 5 acres of land or an entire ecosystem, is a fraction what we have been able to support in our cities by concentrating energy and feeding it down wires so that we can have...
Well, maybe you're a technophile.
No, I'm not a technophile. I'm just stating that the difference between how many people the Earth, the planet, can support just living off of, you know, nuts, berries, and water power compared to... and I don't like the way that we're gaining energy now by burning carbon or, you know, creating superheated steam and turning turbines and all this inefficient way of creating energy. I think, in my opinion, that there are other natural ways of supplying energy, whether it's tapping into the magnetic flow in sort of a dynamo way and generating electricity that way, or tapping into solar radiation or into gravitational radiation. Mm-hmm. And these things wouldn't necessarily drain the ecology, and they certainly wouldn't pollute the ecology.
Mm-hmm.
But my provocative question was...
Well, Gene, it would take a culture-wide or a planetary, if you're doing planetary, enlightenment to get that to happen. Bucky Fuller had a technophile solution for the world power needs.
And that was?
His system was, I called it a world energy grid, and he designed... based on his big world map, or actually foldable geodesic world map, that would create an energy grid going through all the continents. Well, that's already happening, but it's satellite. Now it's microwave. It's not terrestrial energy,
uh-huh.
Electricity, AC power. So his vision is still being promoted by a few of the Fullerites of the global energy grid. And they're technophiles. They think that technology is the solution to all the problems. Well, the way Fuller had calculated was that there is enough resources and there is enough energy if we would just do it efficiently. But we seem to be invested in waste. We seem to be almost enchanted or worshipping waste in terms of how big things are and how fast they are and how many things you can buy and own and throw away and newspapers. You know, you get a book a day and a newspaper and then you throw it away. So it's like, it's astounding. And people get... it'd be 365 newspaper books per year, and they throw them all away. But now we're recycling them, so that's different. But still, the process of killing a forest and then making paper with sulfur gases come off of, and it pollutes the rivers and the air with making paper, and then we have all the shipping of all the wood and the papers and shipping it around. So it's a tremendous waste. Newspapers are tremendous waste, toilet paper and so on. So even if we... It would take an enlightenment. So Fuller came up with this planetary grid, 30, 40 years ago, and it hasn't happened. Why? Because the politics are divisive. It's competition, and it's very kind of Darwinian that there's a scarcity. It's called Malthus theory. There's a scarcity of resources on Earth, and there's not enough, so the empires have to get as much as they can and take it home and make technology out of it, and that's the way it works now.
Well, I agree with a couple of things. I agree that there is control over energy, hoarding of energy, if you will, marketing of energy, not allowing people to have access to energy too cheaply. But I don't believe that there's any kind of shortage of energy. I mean, there's enough oil to last for 10,000 years. It's constantly reforming and never.
Oh, you've heard of the Thomas Gold deep hot biosphere thing?
That and also space. Sources of hydrocarbons like cometary tails, ancient cometary.
Yeah, so there's an endless supply of oil. It's just a matter of distribution then.
Well, yes, and I think it could even be distributed. The problem is that it is a polluting way of creating energy, burning oil in the form of gasoline, natural gas, any of these. I don't think it can be made clean enough for a perpetual kind of system.
Right. Yeah, and we're polluting ourselves to death is what was happening.
Yeah.
But there's two camps. One camp says it's caused by humans. There's three camps. One says it doesn't matter. Pollution can't hurt me. You know, it's infinite space. We can just keep polluting forever. Two is that there's a endless supply of oil. The other is that we're killing ourselves with all the pollution, and the human pollution is the cause of global warming. But all those three camps deny that the sun is creating several times more energy now than it has before.
Yes, I agree with that. And one need only look at the global warming that's occurring on other planets in the solar system.
Yeah, that's
see that. But that and I think that there's a lot of political hay and maybe economic hay being made out there about, you know, the behemoth United States, the glutton United States, the big polluter United States, and all of the political pressures applied in the name of cleaner air are just a lot of political hooey. You know,
well, we actually do have. If you go, have you been to the third world recently?
No, I haven't.
Well, the air in the cities and certain areas where it blows are way more polluted than America.
It didn't used to be that way. When I was a young boy in Los Angeles, the air was filthy. And technology and the pressures, the economic, ecological pressures that the Society of California placed on industry and placed on the automotive industry are what are responsible for the clean air that's there now.
Well, that's good. And our gasoline is cleaner. The thing that's really killing the air in the third world countries is diesel.
Right.
And that's one of the most polluting and toxic things that we're putting into the air. It's, well, I don't want to complain about that much more. So my solution, and it's not mine, but I love it, is permaculture. And that if we live very simply, but then looking at the culture as a whole, all this gluttonous use of luxury and technology and waste, we're unaware of waste, that there's only going to be 1 to 10% of the people are actually going to do permaculture, but there's already half the people on Earth are doing permaculture right now.
Interesting. How does it work?
Well, if you take, I was mentioning about China, about having a valley where everything is integrated and the compost is put into biogas and makes into biomass and makes biogas, which is methane.
Uh-huh.
You can generate a lot of your energy needs from methane, which burns very clean.
Yes,
so
it does.
That's a short-chain
hydrocarbon.
Yeah, it's a local system, and it's a self-reliant system or a biofeedback system or whatever you want to call it. So there's China. Now maybe half the people of China are doing this. I don't know. That would make, 600, 700 million people in China, the rural people. See, not all China is civilized like we think. I mean, they're going very fast to civilize, but then the cities are growing fast. But China has always been a rural culture, and it's just a little bit less now. And they have more electricity and more trains and cars. But the point is that in Asia, Africa, and South America, some in Australia. Actually, Australia has a lot of permaculture, like hippie-type people doing permaculture, thousands of them. So we who do permaculture are more in love with the earth than we are with the cities, politics, money, or any of that. And we feed the earth, and the earth feeds us, whether it's food or trees or foraging or animals or whatever. And
right.
Some people would say, well, I don't want to go back and live like a caveman. Well, you just haven't experienced this. So you don't know what you're talking about.
It's actually quite pleasurable. I love to be in nature. I love to camp. I love to go up in the mountains try to be as close to one with the nature as I can be.
Well, permaculture can be very hard work, or it can be very no work. I live in both kinds of places. I prefer the low work, where I work maybe 2 or 3 hours a day. And I keep feeding nature and weeding and mulching and composting and feeding the animals and trimming and, you know, watching the patterns, shade and the light and the water and solar power. And we got a solar hot water heater. And, you know, it's just a very wonderful life. Keep building and improving. The trees get more fertile. They give more fruit or vegetables or... You learn fertility patterns, and you do the soil composting thing better, and it keeps getting more fertile and growing better. You collect the seed, and you replant it. And It's just the cycles are wonderful. They're so multiple.
Well, I agree with that. And
I can't hear you.
If you can get to a place where...
I'm sorry, there's an airplane going overhead. I'm living in the power grid.
It would be nice to live in an area where you had hydropower, like a waterfall or a moving river, where you could, you know, fashion some kind of a wheel, so you'd have some kind of turning, you know, grinding.
Yeah. Well, there's actually a thing called low head hydro, which is like a very small turbine.
Uh-huh.
And you would say it was the size of a suitcase to the size of a car, and well, a small car. And it's run in streams and small rivers, and you can carry them in, or you know, cart them in. Carts are by the way, bikes and carts are very big in permaculture.
Carts. And what's the output of such a machine?
The planes are coming again. I think I'm being dive bombed over here. Oh, I know
I hear
what it is. It's the Sunday drivers with their little airplanes, and they go out for Sunday drives in the sky. Oh, isn't it pretty? The lake is over there, and the trees, and oh, they're planting, oh, they're harvesting, and oh, they're burning the field. Oh, my God. They actually burn the fields here in the Llano Valley. They burn them. It is so ugly. They grow a lot of grass. Eugene, Willamette Valley, the Willamette Valley, Portland, Eugene, is very fertile.
Yep.
Due to a cataclysmic flood called the Missoula Flood that took topsoil from central Washington around Yakima and brought it all the way down to the Willamette Valley and up the Willamette Valley. Now it's up the Willamette Valley from the Columbia and then out to the ocean, to the Pacific. And that's well known.
And there are large fescue farms there.
Fescue? Grass?
Yes.
Yeah, huge. And in fact, the rumor has, and this is very, this is as unpermaculture as you can possibly get. The farms grow the grass seeds. They kill the plants. They take the seeds. They burn the plants. Send the carbon into the air, and then send the grass seed out to the golf courses. That's as bad as you can get. Well, I mean, ecologically, it's pretty bad. It's like.
I actually,
they're cutting a forest for toilet paper.
I actually drilled a well, a gas well, in Eugene back in 1987. On a fescue farm.
I don't know why, but I still can't hear you. Oh, well, wait. The airplane. Okay, we had another airplane.
Yeah, you have a little bit of outside noise there. But I actually drilled a well in Eugene in 1987 on a fescue farm.
For water?
Actually... they were hoping to find oil.
Oh, come on.
Yeah, I told them that there was natural gas there.
No. Impossible.
We had to drill through the basalt to get to it.
Well, they must have had a lot of money on spec.
Yep, they did.
Well, I don't usually think farmers are that speculative. Usually you have to deal with... you know, the water supply and right now and so on. I mean, I know I was in Sedona and they had to go down hundreds of feet to get water.
Right. Right. Well, I do want to let our guests know that you can call in. We will answer just about any question you want to ask about this. Our U.S. numbers are 877-876-5227. In Canada, it's 888-810-8322. Anywhere else on the planet or off planet, if you've got enough power to reach a cell phone tower, it's 530-876-3222, and you can also reach us through AOL Instant Messaging by going to just search out my name. My username is Vision Officer. You should be able to find me there. I do have some people communicating with us while we're on the air right now. And my guest is Michael Sunanda. I am most impressed with the amount of information that he has accumulated on two linked websites. And the easiest way to find them is to either Google or Yahoo search the words Sunergy, S-U-N-E-R-G-Y, or Ecosma, or Ecosma, E-C-O-Z-M-A, Z as in zebra, M-A. And we will take phone calls the rest of this hour and our third hour. We're going to be talking a little bit more about Earth's interaction with the solar system and the universe and see if we've got some information there that's interesting to you, and you school kids might be able to bring it up to your life sciences or natural science teachers when you go to school this next week. Should be very interesting responses. Yeah, it will blow their minds. If they came from government schools, they're not really going to be up on this. But if they listen to X Squared Radio, they certainly will be. We have this last hour been talking about the prospect of reaching some kind of individual balance with nature, in the sense that you give back to nature, maybe not exactly what she gives you, but what she needs, so that both of you can stay in balance. That tone means we have a caller on the line. Caller, could you give us your first name and where you're calling from?
Sure. My name is Ravi. I'm calling from Alabama.
Great. What's your question?
Well, I heard the earlier part of the program where you're talking about the vortices and energy lines.
Right.
I was wondering if there's any, if one should seek or avoid living near or around those lines of vortices. Is there any benefit for it, or is there any negative just staying too long in those areas?
Did you hear the question, Michael?
No, could you do that for me?
The question was, if you avoid living near these energy grid or ley lines, is there a benefit for it?
Well, see, the vortex power spots and the ley lines, each place has a different effect. So they're really avoiding them is only, you only avoid them if it's a negative one, but you have to kind of test it in your area, which there's ways you can do. You can meditate, you can do dowsing, you can do magnetic field, you know, gyroscopes, compasses. There's lots of different ways, dowsing rods, pendulums, to test the magnetic fields of the vortexes around your place. Or you can just go and look at how the trees are growing. The trees are very good biofeedback of what's happening under the ground, the fertility of the area, and the magnetic fields there, because trees are a magnetic field themselves. So you really need to tune into the bioregion or the neighborhood or the fertility of your area, the watershed, where the weather's coming from, how it affects people, because people are if you're not into TV all the time, people are sensitive enough to feel the nature energy. And there's a thing called geopathic stress, which is that people get sick if they are over, if they live in places that are have a negative vortex. And the most famous of the well-known for the dowsers is underground water currents that are crossing. In other words, there are two different water currents at different, I guess, elevation, not the right word, different depths, and they cross. And if they cross, the water currents under and the water table cross underneath the house, it creates a really bad vortex in the house, and people get very sick in the house for generations. And this is mostly in Europe, because in America, people usually don't get sick unless there was a Native American graveyard there. Well, these are just some of the things you need to check for.
Okay. Are there any places that you know of that are considered very beneficial to be living in?
That's a good question.
Beneficial.
Yeah.
Well, yes and no. And, I mean, there are thousands of places that are beneficial, but it depends on your goals and why and what kind of place you want to live. Now, if you take permaculture, which I do and I teach, then what we're looking for is fertility of the soil and the bioregion and the water supply and the weather and the animals that come through, and we're looking for the most balanced, fertile, safe, ecologically integrated place in the bioregion. So what kind of place is beneficial, it depends on what your lifestyle is or your needs or your health condition. Then you can decide on, because if you're just looking for benefits, there's a value system. Whatever value system you have, you use that to choose where you live.
Right. If you need to have some kind of communication so that you can reach out to maybe other civilizations or special spiritual communion, then there are vortexes that are really strong for that. If you need to have serenity, or like Michael's talking about, a permaculture, an area that's sort of like a Garden of Eden that's much more fertile than areas around it, for survivability or for production, for supply to you, then you look for vortexes that provide that.
Okay. All this is very new to me, so let me ask you another question. Is that information put together anywhere, either on a website or in a book or anything that someone could access fairly easily?
He's asking that if the Earth grid or the vortex is published anywhere so that he can...
Well, there is a map, actually a few maps, on vortexmaps.com.
Okay. During the earlier part of the program, you mentioned that. So I went and downloaded their attachment for Google Earth.
Uh-huh.
And that was very interesting. Only I don't really know how to interpret what those lines are about.
Yeah, how do you line that up with roads?
Roads? Highway?
Yeah, how do you line it up so you can actually find the vortex? So where is it geographically?
Well, this is quite a mystery because the vortex maps, the Earth-Star vortex, geodesic vortexes, are really large. And what you need to do is go outside of your city and start going in the hills and the rivers and so on and begin to learn the biosphere you live in. And if you don't like the biosphere that you live in, the bioregion that you live in, then you can go, I would go to the water somewhere and pray. In other words, go to a lake, a river, the ocean, a glacier or something, if glaciers are disappearing. And pray and meditate and camp out there until the spirit of nature tells you where you're supposed to go. And then maybe you go there and then you do land searches. And land searches are very common in permaculture and any homesteading. You search for the kind of land you'd like to live on. And you may not, if you're just in the city and you've never really done gardening or studying these things, then it may take you years to learn the kind of land place that you would really love to live on for the rest of your life. It's a big span. It's a big range of experience and years. It's not a 5-year plan. This is, we're talking, in permaculture, we do a 20-year minimum, and then we go up to 100 years.
Caller, did you have a specific reason or desire for wanting to find a vortex or be able to identify them?
Well, personally, I feel like I've done what I'm doing and what I need to do here where I'm living right now in Huntsville, and I'm looking to be moving and traveling. For what I'm looking for, I suppose at this time, it would be spiritual, to understand, better, great understanding. UFOs are always an interesting topic, but I don't know anything about that.
I don't know much about it either, but I'm interested.
But if that would be part of the understanding, that would be very interesting. And I guess a little bit of serenity. Permaculture isn't really what I'm looking for at the moment. Putting down roots is a little bit tricky for me. But I am looking for a place that's serene and very easy to, or very conducive to a spiritual clarity.
Spiritual clarity. And I think that the ancients kind of tapped into that as well, and they lined up their churches and their spiritual centers from Stonehenge, maybe further south than that, all the way up into northern Scotland, lining up specifically on these vortex intersections. The more ley lines they could get to cross, the better.
Yeah.
So it does seem that there is an influence, at least on the human psyche, to be able to tap into things beyond the normal conscious mind.
Well, I guess that's part of the question here, is whether those vortices and the influences are fairly uniform across the population, where everybody would react in a similar way to that crossing or that vortice, or is it a little more individual, that certain people will benefit greatly from an area where other people might have problems?
Now, that's a good question, Michael. What do you think?
What is it?
He wanted to know if, given a certain vortex, would everybody feel the same thing or the same benefit, or are the vortexes such that they have different results with different people?
The second is true. The same is true with crop circles and waterfalls and things like and hiking. If you hike up into the mountains, each person will have a little different experience. If the two people that you're comparing are very similar in their emotional and their constitution, and they're energetic, then they may have several influences. But vortexes are tend to be anomalous. So, like, if you take an amusement park or a sports or whatever, people tend to be kind of programmed to have the same experience, or maybe concerts and so on. But in nature, it's way more diverse than that. Now, animals tend to be not so different as we are. So the animals would be attracted, a whole bunch of animals would be attracted to one spot. The natives would do that when they would locate their villages. And we call them eco-villages, but that they're usually overbuilt in America. We have lots of eco-villages, but they're overbuilt. But still, going out into nature and not thinking about what other people are going to experience with this place and just going on your attraction. What are you attracted to? There's a really a good series of books, which are kind of spiritual, but they're called The Celestine Prophecy. And
Robert Redfield, is that it?
Yeah, and The Tenth Insight. And they're both based on an intuitive flow where you go out in nature and you go with the flow of your intuition and you're guided to what you're attracted to. Now, I used to, when I went out in nature a lot before, I would just go out and find a tree and lay under it. I would find a tree that really attracted me, and the sun and the wind, you know, and just the local weather at the moment, and lay down under the tree and kind of breathe and chant and meditate and do yoga. So there's lots of ways. Some people climb trees for that. I mean, that's a neat way to do biolocation, is you go out and climb a tree and see how far you can see.
I used to spend a lot of time lying under trees or in a tree. It used to be a wonderful experience for me. I guess I've gotten away from that as I've gotten older.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think as we grow up, we get more into our, I got to have four walls and a big bedroom and a big screen TV mentality. And when I would visit my in-laws, they always had big farms and had big forests attached to it. And I used to love to go walking in the woods, especially when it was snowing. I feel such serenity when I am walking in the woods while it's snowing.
Wow. Yeah, it is. It's awesome. One of my first visions of four-dimensional space was in the woods. And I had been programmed to think in flat and lines before.
Uh-huh.
And so, because I went to college, I got a degree and taught school. Then all of a sudden, when I was in the woods, I started seeing depth in the woods, multiple dimensions in the woods. And if you look in the woods, like pictures and photographs, they're all flat.
Yeah.
You get in the woods, it's very deep, it's very complex. And that's very enchanting. But then also the thing of laying under a tree or on the ground or by the water. Many times I'd gone down to the water for healing, meditation, relaxation, inspiration. Just go next to the water.
Yeah.
And if I'm really hot or if I'm sick or I need a wake up, I would get in the river. Now, where I live, there's a river fairly close by, but very few people go down there and actually relax by the river. I mean, we're talking less than 1% of the people here. So they're stuck indoors.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember walking back from the Little Bear restaurant not far, about a mile and a half from James's, just walking beside the stream that flows there by the street.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so serene, just the wind blowing or maybe a bee going by and just
uh-huh.
the water. It's just all the worries of the world, all the stress, all the tension built up in me just melted away.
Mm-hmm. Well, your experience is your proof. And I, not ideas. And I call ideas or experience and theory or evidence. In other words, to me, theory is not true. It's never really true. Only evidence is true.
Sure.
And in human terms, we call that experience.
Okay. I want to thank you both. This has been a wonderful conversation and very inspirational.
Yeah, no problem. My pleasure. Thanks for calling in. We ran a little long in that segment. Thank you very much for calling. We wanted to stay with you as long as you could.
I appreciate it. It's put me back in touch with some of the things that I really do enjoy in nature and sort of pulling me outside from these four walls, as you're saying.
Well, great.
Thank you again.
Hope you come back and listen again.
Absolutely. Right. Good night.
Good night. All right. Michael, I've got to take another 6 or 7 minute break. If you want to take a break, we'll be right back.
Yeah,
okay?
Call me back. Love. Bye.
All right.
Do you think it's possible you've existed for thousands of years? The new book in the Universal Learning Series by Sandy Andrews called Your Never-Ending Life will shine light on memories you once dismissed as impossible. When you're finished with this book, you will realize why and how you can relish all the beauty and sadness in all your lives. Search your higher mind, find your soulmate, and know that you are never alone in this world. You can find the book easily by clicking the Universal Learning Series banner at X Squared Radio. Just about everyone owns an inkjet printer. You could buy a printer for less than a couple of tanks of gas. But the inkjet cartridges are costly. If you buy a color and black cartridge at a national superstore, you'll spend about $80. Well, those high-priced days are now over. If you click the 123 inkjet banner at X Squared Radio, you may be able to replace a cartridge for the price of movie admission for two. Plus, every time you shop at 123 Inkjet, you get a chance to win a free printer. How cool is that? Add to that the free shipping, and you have an untouchable bargain. Next time you run low on those vibrant color inks, think of X Squared Radio and start saving money. You know, thus is the place where the past meets the future. If you have done your genealogy and found that you have roots in the Irish or Scottish clans, then don't you think it would be a great idea to have a replica of your family crest? You can get a coat of arms, a ring, or even a family tartan that may help you or your grandchildren remember your ancestors. This is the time when the hearts of the children are turned to the hearts of the fathers. We only carry the best. So if you're ready to experience the glory of your past, you're ready to visit Scottish Heirlooms at X Squared Radio. Many people write us here at X Squared Radio wanting to know how to get prepared for the coming cataclysms. Well, we have been successful in acquiring the best affiliate in the world for emergency preparedness. NitroPak has been around for 18 years and can provide everything you need for life. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a year's supply of excellent quality foods and supplements for a single person or whole family. Don't be left without the essentials of life. NitroPak is the name. Click the banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. The foundations of religion and science were used to restore knowledge lost for over 6,000 years in our first book. The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, called 2012 and Harvest of the End Times, brings us vital knowledge for the race of mankind. Have the Watchers returned? What did the Aztecs mean by their ancient predictions for the year 2012? Why is Earth changing so rapidly now before our very eyes? Who were the Shining Ones who lived on the Earth and worked with mankind as they recovered from cataclysm? Who are we? Where did we come from? If you could find a book that answers just one of these questions, you'd buy it. Now there are two of the series that is sweeping the world with its message. Go to arcofmillionsofyears.com and get your autographed copy today. Now, also available in full audio version. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. We want to welcome you back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. This is where the past meets the future. A lot of people may not understand why we call this program X Squared Radio. We try to make sure all the results are positive here. Any number times itself is positive, except for one. And that one number is I. I is the square root of negative one. If you square I, you end up with negative one. So we don't talk too much about I. The show is about you, the caller, you, the listener, the information, the guests that we bring you each week. We're trying to bring you the best knowledge with the best interviews and the best guests on planet Earth. Of course, in here we discuss the mysteries of the universe, of the Earth, and we're looking for not just the truth, but discovery, and those things that would be interesting to you for us to discover about the universe and the Earth. Many of our listeners write emails to us and give us the names of guests to interview. You can always go to BBS Radio and suggest a guest for X Squared Radio. We'd like you to do that. We're a proud member of the BBS Radio Network. Their motto is, if it's not mainstream, it's on BBS Radio. We're a little, not maybe mainstream, but we are sort of out a little bit beyond the beam of mainstream camera lights. So we try to bring you that information just beyond that light. You'll find that as we do that, it will open your mind. You'll begin to look at the news a little differently, politics a little differently, and maybe even your scriptures a little differently as the planet and its relation to the universe unfolds before you. Each hour, we try to bring you the very best content that we can. That accumulates in our archives, which we mix down for your listening pleasure. Up to this week, we have accumulated those and allowed you to listen to those for free. We've done that so that we can build our audience and you can build your knowledge base. And now it has come to the time where we can no longer provide those for free. We are only charging $2.50 for a month's access, and you don't just get access to one show. You get access to everything we've done since September of 2005. So if you want to listen to 160 hours of content with your 1 month of $2.50, you can certainly do that. We would encourage you to buy your subscription, which is only $20, which is far less than $2 per month, less than the price of a cup of coffee. And then you can access the archives anytime you want from any computer you want using your username and password. And you can access the interviews anytime and download them, put them on CDs, listen to them in your car, put them on your iPod, whatever you want to do with them. Share them with a friend so that we get more knowledge out. A lot of you might also be aware that we are getting ready to form a new foundation.
which will be designed to fund and manage the logistics of the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition coming up hopefully in 2007. If we can get our funding together quick enough and make our boat reservations soon enough, we will still make the 2007 summer season. We don't want to travel to the North Pole in the winter. It's dark, and the ice forms rather deep and rather broad, and it takes a long, long time to break through all that. For the last 100 years or so, no one has been able to get to the spot that we have in mind for an inner Earth opening. Only recently, like in the last 5 years, have the ice patterns, ocean currents, and weather agreed enough to allow an icebreaker to get to the point where we need to get to in order to bring you back the information. So we want you to stay current with us and watch what's going on there. If you want to donate to that, there's a link to do that on the website. Anybody that donates, their name will go in any publications that we have anything to do with or any filming releases that we have anything to do with it. And if you want to tell your grandchildren that you were involved in the what we believe is the greatest geological expedition in the history of the world, you can do so by showing them your copy and your name in the credits. So we offer that to you as an opportunity. Obviously, if forces come up against us and we're never able to take this expedition, not only will we fully refund your money to you as we're required to by law, but also ethically we would do that. But we would still publish the book in 2007, and you would still get credit for participating in that effort. So that's open to you in case you want to make yourself just as important as a big corporate donation. You can certainly do that. Every single donation that we've had so far has the benefit of our love and appreciation, as well as that credit that goes with it. We here at X-Squared Radio are a patient lot. We have grown slowly at first, but now it appears the numbers are in. We're growing at a rate of about 167% per quarter, and that's a phenomenal growth rate in this business. We think we're doing that because I'm trying to bring you the best content, I'm trying to keep things positive, and we've been able to bring you this content at extremely low cost, or free if we can. So if my producer will call back Michael Sunanda for our final segment.
Do that right now.
We can get about
35
minutes
for
you. All right. My guest Michael Sunanda is back for our final segment. We can make about 32 minutes out of this. I did have a question for you because you got some wonderful information on these two websites, which anybody can find just by searching out the two terms Sunergy, S-U-N-E-R-G-Y, or Ecosma, E-C-O-Z-M-A. And believe me, there'll be days worth of reading there if you want to come up to speed with the research that Michael has done. But I wanted to ask you a question. You have a theory that there's a fourth dimensional shift coming. And in my understanding, this means that there is currently at least two phases of matter or energy existing at this point in space we call Earth. As the higher of the two frequencies begins to shift away from the lower frequency, we have a choice to make. Do we think we should raise our energy level to harmonize with the higher frequency or not? At least that's my take on it. What is your opinion?
Well, in Qigong, I would just reframe that in saying that you raise your personal vibrations. This goes back to shamanic practice forever. And the mystics. Now, some of the mystics would automatically get enlightened at a certain point. They had done enough suffering or work or learning or whatever, and they would just get enlightened, and it would just suddenly happen that they were aware of dimensions that they weren't aware of before. So when you say we are entering a fourth dimensional shift, I don't believe in the we, although a lot of people are. But for everybody, it's individual. Enlightenment is an utterly unique process for every person. Healing, spiritual healing, awareness, meditation. I've done dozens of different kinds of meditation, and what works the easiest is just stopping your mind. But of course, most people's minds are based on their conditioning from the past, so they don't
they don't their mind is kind of like a wild monkey. It's out of control. It just keeps thinking weird thoughts and future thoughts, past thoughts, negative thoughts, rational thoughts, business thoughts, time, and all that stuff. And they don't stop and either just meditate on the patterns of nature or pure love, or meditating on your breath. So the Buddhists, and this is called Vipassana, is you just sit and meditate on your breath. You just focus on your breath, and your thoughts are different. Your thoughts will come and go and come and go, and if you can just keep letting them go and letting them go. So there's a 10-day meditation where you just meditate for maybe 8 to 12 hours a day for 10 days, and it causes various levels of enlightenment, but everybody who does it in a group gets a different experience. So to me, the fourth dimension is just another phrase for expanded awareness, enlightenment, centering. In Sufi, we call it centering. I'm a Sufi, and we call it centering is devotion, is meditation. In yoga, it's called sadhana, which means practice. So each different religion or spiritual trip, in the Christian, they would call devotion to God or something like that.
Right.
And each system, each guru, each practice is somewhat different.
So the process of raising one's vibrational level or raising their energy level, not in the sense of getting excited or putting yourself in a frenzy, quite the opposite, finding some point of serenity or peace where not only do you not want to do any harm, but you revere all life. This is done through these meditative practices?
Yeah, even a long hot bathtub or going camping. Whatever you need to become more trusting, more intuitive, more open, more learning. For me, I started doing yoga in the spring of 71 after my wife left. And I was slowly becoming a hippie over a period of 2 years, but I didn't know it exactly. I was attracted to a lot of hippie things, but nature things, but I didn't really know I was becoming a hippie. I kind of wanted to be. So suddenly she realized that I was becoming a hippie and thinking, oh, this is crazy. This guy is going nuts. Which a lot of straight people would say that, you know. I mean, that's what they think. Oh, my son has gone crazy. My parents thought that for sure. Oh, my son's gone crazy. He's quit work, you know. Well, I quit work to get a master's degree in family counseling, which I did, and it was very good, and it was a cooperative parenting thing. And my wife did not want to do cooperative parenting. She didn't want to cooperate with the kids. She wanted to boss them all the time, which most parents do. But if you're very respectful to your kids, you ask them lots of questions. And you learn, you know, what they need and want on the moment, rather than think, well, my kid needs this, and I'll give him this today, tomorrow, and, you know, and so on. So it's like learning how to learn again. And in Sufi, we learn how to learn all the time from everything. And that is a meditation, because you're becoming receptive. You're becoming more soft or feminine or receptive or sensitive to what's going on around. You see, animals have needs. Plants have needs. See, every human has needs. And our needs are slightly different, but the respect is, you have needs, I have needs. I respect your needs, I respect my needs. I respect my needs a little bit more than yours, but if my needs are filled, then I can serve your needs. Or maybe it's, I need to serve. So there, it goes both ways.
I definitely agree with the seeking some kind of support or balance or sensitivity or at least respect for those things going on around you. But how does disturbing the delicate natural balances of cosmic energies on spaceship Earth affect things?
Well, Qigong and yoga and being in nature without a watch and, you know, without time and just a little bit of food, is they are ways of surrendering to the universe, to the spirit. But it's being called by nature, called by the spirit. We need to go through the world game for a while. Most people who grow up really natural join the world game for a while. They get jobs and all that stuff. And it's strange. I know a lot of people, I mean, I'm a grandpa. I know a lot of people who, hippies, who had kids, and the kids are raised as a hippie for, you know, 5, 10, 15 years, and then they go off and join the world. They go to cities and stuff. So
right.
There's no certain route that you go through. It's an experiment. It's an experimental thing. You're experimenting with something you haven't tried because what you had before just didn't fill your needs anymore. Needs change.
Well, what activities do you think are the most harmful or frighten you the most? Those of the entrepreneur, you know, trying to find new sources of energy or revenue, or the perma-war economy that seems to finance every technology that shows even the remotest promise of producing a new weapon?
Well, without getting political, which is very easy to bitch and moan about the politics, I like to go into what is the nature of the energy sources you're using. How, and this fits with peak oil and the climate crisis, is what you're doing creating any pollution or toxins? Furthermore, are you eating or drinking or taking any toxins? And the toxins in the environment that we take or make or ignore or whatever are acids. Those are the toxins. Almost all of the chemical toxins, whether it's air, water, or food, are acids. And the pesticides, insecticides, the smoke, the chemical pollution, they're all acids. Well, there's a few that aren't, but most
really?
Of them are acids. So if you take, if you get sick or you want to get healthy, then you take alkalines, you get minerals, natural kinds, not chemical, not laboratory vitamins and minerals. Those are not natural. Those do actually, when you eat the synthetic vitamins and minerals,
yeah,
you poop them out. Your body does not absorb them very well.
I've heard that from people that pump septic tanks.
Yeah, and I also take a lot of fermented foods. I eat nutritional yeast, I eat cheese and yogurt and kefir. I drink a quart of kefir a day. It's very good for digestion. But I have a lot of experience in health for 35 years. When I got my first college degree within health and PE, I became sick because it's unnatural health. It's programmed factory health science.
Wow.
And it's not healthy. And I could go into the corruption of each of the food industries. But on the global warming thing, the food industry in total, the total amount of energy consumed by the food industry is bigger than any other industry in America.
From diesel fuel for tractors,
yeah.
And
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and shipping the foods here and there, and processing them, and packaging them, and selling them in the markets. See, the price of the food includes profits for every single one of those industries that it has to go through. So you'll find that farmers' markets are actually cheaper than, except for a few foods, cheaper than the factory foods in the commercial market. And here where we are, we started the national organic standards in the 1970s, in the late 70s. We started doing organic growing, and then certification came out of that in the 80s. So this is kind of the home base or the root or the origin, the rebirth of organic farming and gardening here in the Northwest.
Well, explain to me. I hear that as kind of a marketing term in certain areas of the supermarket. What is organic gardening?
Oh, well, the contrast, and this relates to global warming, because the farms that are monocrop, they have one crop in a field. That's very unnatural. Nature does not do that. Well, there is one exception. There are some meadows or prairies that have grasses, and they'll have, well, actually, they even have mixed kinds of grasses. So it's very unnatural to have one kind of grass, plants, bushes, trees, cactus, whatever, in an area. That's unnatural. But what makes it even worse is they put in chemical fertilizer, pesticides, and herbicides, and then the packaging, which, and a lot of time processing, they cook the food before it's sent to you. And then they want you to cook it again, so you killed it twice.
Wow.
So raw foods have much more energy than cooked foods.
How about that?
The more times you cook a food, the more times you process a food, the less energy it has. Well, what is your source of energy? Are you aware of your source of energy? Is it like, oh, that energy is I throw the switch, I push the button, that's your energy. Well, that's factory-made energy somewhere else. It's imported to you. You pay through the nose for it. Growing something in nature, growing something in fertile soil is so healthy. It's so good for your body to get on the ground and get a little dirty and eat the fresh food. If you eat really fresh food, in the 20s, they started outlawing raw milk.
Now, raw milk is legal in most countries in the world.
Right.
In fact, it's prized as a wonderful thing in most countries in the world. And there are hundreds of villages where they make, they have their milk, they have their cattle, they have sheep, goat, cow, yak, camel, milk. They milk these animals, all these different animals.
Huh.
It's a shock. It's a shock. We have this factory society. And furthermore, a lot of people are lactose intolerant, they call it. They're allergic to milk. They won't drink milk. I didn't drink milk for 20 years when I was a vegetarian, although I had yogurt. And I think that the allergy to milk is based on the chemicals they put in the milk.
You know, I think you're probably right there.
Yeah.
Because I know I had a son who had some problems with natural milk, dairy milk, when he was a kid. I mean, just couldn't keep it down. So we switched him to goat's milk, which doesn't go through all that kind of processing.
Mm-hmm.
And he settled right down. Everything mm-hmm. was great.
Yeah. Yogurt, you can make yogurt at home from milk. But if you use pasteurized milk, then it's hard to make it because the microbes are dead.
Do you think maybe some of the neurological problems that we're having, like depression and ADD and these kinds mm-hmm. of things, are brought on by the foods we eat?
Oh, yeah. There's actually a doctor. I think it was a Kaiser doctor. It's kind of a Kaiser's of West Coast. I don't know if they have Kaiser on the East Coast, but they have it out here. It's kind of a industrial fact medical system, but it's a little bit more advanced than the other places. And this doctor named Feingold discovered that if he gave kids a diet of more natural foods and less processed foods and no wheat, you know, cutting out a few of the things that kids are allergic to, their nervous problems, their learning problems, their hyperactivity, whatever you want to call it, focusing systems. You must get focused, you know. Well, that's because they want schools. They want kids to learn how to go to business. You do your schoolwork so you can go to work and get paid and buy junk in the stores. So, and classy taste, of course. So he gave the kids these diets, and they had a very high success rate, like 85%.
85%?
Of the kids who had these learning and nervous problems got cured. By the way, in the 50s, the U.S. medical establishment outlawed the words curing and healing from America.
What?
Yeah, they did. You go back and look. Okay, if you go on the web and you do a search for healing, the word healing or curing,
uh-huh.
this is very specific now, in the medical realm. Now, I'm not talking about the hippie healing, natural health, and herbalism. We heal. We do healing. But see, I don't heal you. Your body heals with the stimulation of the herbs.
Right.
And the massage or the purification. So in the 50s, I call them nice Nazis, the medical establishment became anti-healing. They outlawed the use of the word healing in their systems.
In exchange for the word treatment.
And remission.
Oh, I see, remission. Right, right. Something that's maybe not so permanent might come back, so you better keep buying our drugs.
Yeah. Just keep coming back to us. We don't care if you buy the drugs. We'll fix you. Whatever you come back, we'll give it to you. We'll fix you.
Oh, that's interesting. That's interesting.
So in the 20s, they started outlawing raw milk, and in the 50s, they outlawed healing and curing. And that's one of the things in the marketplace. It's a paradox now, because the natural food industry or the natural health industry, which isn't, I don't really call it an industry, but sort of it, they don't use the word healing and curing in the selling their products. But like I get a product, I'm healthy now, but I get a product called Liver Cleanse. Well, if you know what the liver does, or you know that the liver gets damaged by the acid foods that we've been eating,
right.
Then most Americans have liver damage.
Huh. I didn't know that.
And, well, that means that they're not able to make... See, the liver has the ability to make proteins and carbohydrates and fats out of whatever you eat. But if you eat a lot of high acids, sugars especially, starches, and cooked oil, then your liver gets weak and weaker and weaker and weaker. And that's called aging.
What kind of oil should we use? I mean, like extra virgin olive oil?
That's the best. Organic extra virgin olive oil is the best.
All right.
But there's also raw, unrefined coconut oil
and sesame oil, raw sesame oil. Most of the oils are refined because they, when they extract them from seeds and so on, nuts and seeds, like, you know, like corn oil,
right,
they, it heats it up to extract it.
You know, when I was a kid, they used to cook theater popcorn in coconut oil.
Yeah.
But because of the, quote, cholesterol, they went away from that and went to a vegetable oil.
Yeah.
And ever since then, the popcorn has been like popped cardboard.
Mm-hmm.
If the listener could taste popcorn cooked in coconut oil, you would never eat this stuff they call popcorn in the movie theaters again.
Uh-huh.
It's
great,
but you can't find it anywhere.
Well, we have, I just saw yesterday, I saw two different kinds of raw coconut oil, but they're expensive. They're like $5 to $10 a pound, and that's very expensive. Olive oil is about, well, it's, it ranges from $4 to $8 a pound. But the point is, raw coconut, raw. So, okay, I'd like to point out that the cholesterol, the war on cholesterol started after World War II when the Nazis came to the United States, and that's no secret. It's called Project Paperclip. Everybody who knows about what happened after World War II and studied, you know, transition Europe and Japan and all that stuff, that the Nazis, the ones who were open to coming into our industry came into the industry, hundreds of them. And they started doing rocket science and biochemical things and genetic engineering and so on. And one of the things they did is they figured out how to, this may have been done before the Nazis came, is how to make butter out of corn oil, which is called margarine.
Yeah, margarine. It used to be kind of a clear, gristly thing, and no one bought it till they made it look like butter.
Yeah. So the point is that they started a psychic war on cholesterol, which is, oh, animal and dairy is going to kill you. It's going to give you heart disease. So they're actually doing a psychic fear of death thing on this.
Uh-huh.
The fear of dying from clogging up your arteries with this... with
hog lard.
with animal lard.
Right.
You know, you're going to get greasy tubes and die.
You know, I asked my mother-in-law one time to what she attributed her long life, and she said hog lard. I laughed.
Well, it's maybe true. I don't know. I haven't really gotten into lard. I do a lot of dairy, but it's mostly fermented and cultured butter. And I do I eat raw chicken livers, organic, when I can get them. And because and it's very traditional that the native cultures, when they would it goes back thousands of years. They would eat the organs of the animals that they hunted. But I wanted to mention the doctor who discovered these patterns. His name was Weston Price. He was a dentist. And in the 30s, he was the most successful dentist in the United States, published a textbook on dentistry, which is extremely detailed. I don't know if you know dentistry. It's tremendously detailed.
I have friends that are dentists. They may know it.
Yeah. And so this guy published, he wanted to know when he retired in the 30s, at the peak of his career, he was rich, what caused dental problems and teeth and jaw problems, small jaws, crowded teeth, that whole problem.
Uh-huh.
A problem in many, probably half, I'm guessing, of the people born in the Western culture have crowded teeth.
Oh, in Japan, too.
Yeah.
It's horrible.
Yeah. So he was wondering what causes these things. And if you're really into the depth of patterns and cycles and nature, you want to know the causes of things. In America, they call it the reasons. I don't believe in reasons. I believe in causes. But anyway, so he was traveling to 20 countries around the world in the 30s when they started doing the airline thing, to fly in the airplane. So he went to these 20 countries doing research with 3,500 natives. He took pictures of 3,500 natives' teeth, jaw, and face to study them, to see, because he wondered, why do these white people have all these narrow faces and jaws with crowded teeth and teeth problems? And that's what he saw. He saw thousands of patients, right, in his life, being a dentist. So then he took these pictures, and he found out in this mutation, and this is this is terrible news, that the women who were pregnant, who ate, first time they ate processed food, and they started getting on canned food and sugar and ground up flour and all that stuff that white people love, overcooked whatever, they had mutated babies.
a very high percentage. And then you have pictures of the kids at different ages with their face and their jaws and their crowded teeth and so on. Then you have pictures of the natives who kept eating native food. And their teeth were whole, their mouths were big, they had big noses, big mouths, big eyes, big forehead. You know what they look like. And the white people have narrow faces. And that just all of a sudden opened up this whole thing of, my God, maybe we're the mutated race on Earth.
Wow.
Because if you look at all the brown people, minus some of the people in the Caribbean, the Jews and some of those people in there, Italians or whatever, some of them have broad faces, some of them have narrow faces. But if you go to Africa, Polynesia, not so much in India, they were a little too civilized, Asia, and even some of the more natural the Chinese and a lot of the Chinese have broad faces, moon faces we call them. But the Japanese have gotten more mutated. They're more like white people.
Wow.
Except for their eyes. So this is my theory, that we've mutated ourselves in civilized ways, living indoors, under religion, processed food, alcohol, sugar, and on and on. And the mutation rates in the 20th century are horrendous. And I'm not inventing this at all. There's vast science on the mutations of babies due to the diets of their mothers. The smoking and alcohol and tobacco and taking drugs are well known, tremendously documented.
Sure.
But the people's habits, they're unaware that they don't know that they're causing these things.
Wow. What about the effects on the planet, things that change
right.
The balance of the planet? I don't necessarily mean man, but what about large gravitational events like a passing planet or a giant gravitational wave, something that may have tilted the Earth over in its orbit or something, its rotation.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that changes in the planet itself have had effects on the growth and mutation of humans?
Oh, absolutely. I'm going to extend this to the cataclysmic evolution theory, which I did not invent. It was rebirthed by Volkowski in the 50s and Hapgood in the 90s. The shock waves coming from magnetic anomalies, like if you lived in a magnetic anomaly, it would make you sick, or, for most people it would make them sick. Some people would get higher from it, but comets coming by, Earth axis tilting. My theory is that animals mutate very fast during these sudden cataclysmic events, whether it's a hurricane, a shock wave, earthquake, a volcano, a flood, or whatever. And their mutations happen fairly quickly during conception, pregnancy, and the bonding cycle, when the organs are still forming.
Right.
So those mutations, if they happen during those shock waves, then the animals live, and they live to recreate, to produce more babies. Then those mutations are passed on. And if they're successful, in other words, they proliferate and they grow, lots of babies, and their babies make babies and so on, then they become a new variety or a new species. And Neil Adams has quite a bit on how the reptiles and the dinosaurs mutated and what happened to them. He has a new theory, and if you go on his website, I think it's Community Graphics or something like that, Neil Adams, N-E-A-L Adams, and he was on Coast to Coast, and he has this theory, and he shows animations of how reptiles and dinosaurs mutated and how they got extinct, and then the expanding Earth, which kind of goes in with the thing we're talking about when inside the vortex of the Earth makes lava and
right.
And so on, from the inside of the Earth out.
Uh-huh.
But this is a macro system that he didn't invent the theory. It's been around for about 75 years, that the Earth is actually growing, and they're in the oceans, not on the land, but in the oceans. And he's got a beautifully animated graphics. He's a genius animator, one of the highest, like, Batman-style animators in the 90s. Now he's gone scientific with it. And he still does his cartoon stuff, but he's just got these brilliant NASA-based photographs of what he shows as expanding planets.
How can we find some of his stuff?
Neil Adams on the web, Google.
Okay.
And he was on Coast to Coast, and his stuff is archived there if you're interested in going there, because he, his interviews. And he's very lucid about it.
he's a little bit, he has kind of aiming at scientists, and I don't aim at scientists. I think they're lost in rationality and logic and theory, so I don't really aim for them. But he's trying to get the scientists to go into this radical geology, which is, I think it's hopeless, but anyway, his graphics are just mind-blowingly beautiful. And he takes NASA graphics and shows how the planets Mars, the Moon, the Earth, and one of the moons of Jupiter, I believe? Yeah, the moon of Jupiter have expanded. And there are several other websites and a couple of books. I just got a book from one of the originators of it named Carey. And he was a geologist and was a genius, and nobody believed him. But he published a book on it anyway. So anyway, back to the Earth changes. The health and the Earth changes, the cataclysmic evolution, particularly, and the current global storms and all that. Most of the storms on the Earth now are generated by acids or making acids. Now, carbon dioxide is called carbonic acid or carbonic gas. It's made by nature in the form of methane and CO2 or ethylene, and they're acids. And we call acid rain and acid ocean. So that's what's killing the ocean, is the carbonic acids, or the poison acids from our rivers and pollution, and from the volcanoes that are going off under the sea, and the methane clathrate, the frozen ancient sea sediments at the bottom of the sea and the permafrost in the Arctic.
Mm-hmm.
And they are melting, the volcanoes are heating up, they're melting the permafrost, the sun is heating the air, melting the ice, that's melting the permafrost. They're releasing methane. It's causing more heating faster and faster and faster. So what the heating has been going on now in the last 50 years is quite a bit of acceleration of heating in many, many places, and droughts and storms and all, is going to get worse faster because the accumulation of methane and CO2 in the air and in the ocean.
Well, I agree with that. And I think a lot of people don't realize that methane under pressure remains liquefied. Or frozen, and doesn't really, it isn't as reactive as when it's in a gaseous form. And that there are literally billions of tons of this on the sea floor.
Mm-hmm.
And as the temperature of the ocean rises, it will reach a point of criticality when that liquid methane or frozen methane becomes gaseous methane and makes its way to the surface. And then global warming, or the greenhouse effect that contributes to global warming, will be out of control.
Well, it's going faster, and this year there have been more reports on methane that have come through in the web from scientists than ever before. I've got at least a dozen reports on methane, the increase and the release of methane from under the sea, and it has a different profile than carbon dioxide.
Sure.
It's 20 times stronger as far as absorbing solar energy, but it deteriorates in 10 years. But then what does it become? It becomes CO2, so it's still a greenhouse gas. And the greenhouse gas, according to current science, lasts 100 years, and then it becomes water, it deteriorates after 100 years. So those two things right now are accumulating from nature. See, we can't do a thing about the nature thing. But the Al Gore people, which are growing by the day now, want to stop the pollution from the human side, which I agree with totally. But I've been into that since the 70s. That's nothing new.
No, it's nothing new. I mean, it just makes sense.
Well, it's health. It's the health of nature. It's the health of our bodies. So the acids we put into our bodies, whether it's alcohol, is the most well-known to science acid poison that we put in our bodies. And it's known that alcoholism causes liver disease. Very well known.
Yes, and I think even, you know, occasional uses of alcohol do have detrimental effects, but certainly chronic or regular uses of alcohol are not good for the body.
Well, I would say they're deadly. And actually, if you have natural alcohol and you have it in conscious ways, then it can be healthy, particularly wine. And bitter. Wine and beer can be healthy in very small amounts, similar to coffee, but people overdo it. And so then it attacks their liver.
Right.
I was born with a weak liver, so I started out in trouble.
Well,
I can see that you have overcome it. And the liver is one organ that can rebound. It can heal itself if you give it the right nutrients and treat it correctly. It will correct itself and heal.
But as far as how to do that, Western science cannot help you with that. You have to go to natural and organic and energy, like Qigong is very good for that. Macrobiotics, raw food, they're all, if they're done in balance, they're very good for the liver. But the Western science does not do that. See, Western science doesn't really believe in prevention. They want you to keep coming back and spending money.
Well, that's exactly right. A society of treatment, and as you say, remission, as long as you keep coming in and seeing us.
Well, you know, they never say that they know why you had a remission.
No, they never do. It's just a miracle, you know. We can't explain these things.
Well, the Christians believe they use the word miracle when they mean reason or something, you know.
Yep.
And then the scientists say, well, it's just chance, I'm sorry.
Yeah, but more ancient civilizations know what root and what berry and what seed and what activity to do or not do to correct these things.
Yeah, and then people in Europe were really didn't want tradition, because the Catholics and the witch hunts and all the sickness and plagues and everything, that's partly why they went to the New World. That's partly why our ancestors left Europe, because it was so corrupt and polluted and war-torn and religious paranoia. And
yep.
Let me out of here, you know?
Yeah, exactly right. Yep, and I think there are, as I said before, macroeconomic forces. When I hear people, needing to keep their sugar under control with diabetic drugs, and I think to myself, you know, I'm fairly sure that a vast majority of diabetics could be cured with the right kind of treatment. But
we know what they are.
Yeah.
The herbalists, we know what they are. But see, the missing link in that, in the natural remedy cure herbal thing, is emotions. Because a lot of people will take herbs and they will really help them. But if they don't deal with their emotions, that is the cause of their bad habits, why they're attached to certain toxic foods, then they'll just say, oh, thank God I took this herb and I'm better now. But they don't really know why the emotional root that is from childhood, why they got hooked on these bad foods to begin with. My milk thing, I had no breast milk. I went immediately onto a bottle with sugared, powdered, or evaporated milk, and then I became addicted to milk. Junk milk, poison milk. So, you know, if you went to a farm and you went to the dairy, they don't do dairy tours anymore, you know. They give the cows so much chemicals, and the cows are so unnatural, you know, they don't go outside much, that they don't want people to see that.
Wow.
When I was a kid, we went to a dairy.
Yeah, we did too. There was a dairy that even recycled the waste from the cows and used the methane to run generators, which partially supplied the energy it took to run the farm. I thought it was very ingenious.
Yeah, that's kind of permaculture.
Well,
you know, a lot of places, a lot of farms do a little bit of permaculture here and there, 5%, 10%. But then they have germ theory. Oh no, the compost manure is bad. We have to kill it.
Yeah.
So they don't actually use the manure. But traditionally around the world, the sustainable permaculture communities, farms, recycle their manure into their fields. And they just bury it or you know, dig it in or let it rain in or whatever before, you know, plenty of time before they plant. That's very simple.
Sure. And
germ theory is paranoid.
You know, they talk about virulent E. coli, and there was a very well-published experiment that was just done a few years ago where they took corn-fed beef. And just before they were slaughtered, they switched them over to grass. And they raised one population on corn and one population on grass. And the ones that were raised on grass had no virulent E. coli. The ones raised on corn and feed had tons of it.
Yeah, well, they're unnatural. Those are unnatural those are unnatural feed for cows.
Right.
And all that, by the way, that's another thing that's really bad news about the farming industry. Most of the seed, most of the grains grown in America do not go for our bread. Most of it goes to the cows and the pigs and the chickens.
That's right.
Now, that's
there was
that's
an interesting follow-up to
that's
that.
A tragedy.
Yeah, exactly. And there are nations in the world that are starving, and yet we're feeding our grain to our cattle.
Right.
So that we can have a big steak.
There's actually, just this year, there's been a kind of a vegetarian thing, and I'm not a vegetarian, but they say if eating cows is bad for the greenhouse gas.
For sure.
I mean?
Yeah, because the cow population on our planet is probably 10,000 times or maybe 100,000 times its natural level.
I heard a rumor there were 60 million cows and 40 million pigs in America.
Oh, that's probably true.
I don't know.
There's a good number of them right here in western Kentucky. Well, I think we've had an outstanding 3 hours, and I want to show my appreciation for you being on for 3 hours. You're a wealth of information. We could easily go another 3 hours. I appreciate it. I do have great respect for the knowledge that you've accumulated and the way you've accumulated it. I'm envious, and unfortunately, I've been stuck in the technological world as an engineer for 40 years, and I've been responsible for making cars and wrapping paper and all kinds of things that have harmed the planet. But at least now I've got the passion and the venue to try to make it right and get this knowledge out there as much as I can. And I greatly appreciate you being on X Squared Radio.
Mm-hmm, me too. You're very fun to talk to, and you're very fluid and soft, and I appreciate you.
Well, I appreciate that compliment, and so we'll speak another time. My great guest has been Michael Sinanda. Make sure to search out the two terms, Sunergy, S-U-N-E-R-G-Y, and Ecosma, E-C-O-Z-M-A, and we'll have Michael on the program again, if you will.
I love email, too, by the way.
Oh, very good. What's your email address?
MichaelSpun@Yahoo, and it's MichaelSpun.
Very good. All right. Appreciate you being on the program, and we'll talk another time.
We'll be in touch.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
Love, bye.
All right. This is Brooks Fackney with X Squared Radio, and we will be playing our exit here. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us. Because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe. So try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.